These people shaping our politics, our country and the world. Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson. Discover the whole back catalogue right now on BBC Sounds.
And Nick's next guest is the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch. That's on Saturday afternoon at 5.30 on Radio 4.
Good morning. Hello. It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 26th of November. It's good to be with you. This is Today with Johnny Diamond and Emma Barnett.
The headlines today: extending the freeze on income tax thresholds is expected to be at the centre of a budget which is being seen as crucial for the government's fortunes. And President Trump has said the US is making progress in its peace negotiations with Ukraine and Russia. His special envoy will meet President Putin in Moscow next week. We'll hear from one of his first term appointees about how the administration sees the deal and Europe's role.
We will also, in today's programme, after a three-year wait, the show that put Netflix on the map, Stranger Things, is finally back.
This isn't like one of your campaigns. You don't get to write the ending. Not this time.
But has the wait whetted appetites or lost the show its momentum? Turner and Constable go head-to-head at the Tate. Yeah, I've never said that before. And the Farne Islands Puffins are in trouble. I was wondering what puffins sounded like this morning, and the Today programme has delivered for us all. The number of breeding pairs, I'm sad to report, has dropped by almost a quarter, but there will be some good news as well to share on that front. But first, the BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is expected to announce a freezing of income tax thresholds in the budget as part of attempts to raise billions of pounds in extra revenue for the Treasury. This would see people being dragged into a higher tax band or paying tax on their income for the first time if they get a pay rise. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Rachel Reeves will deliver a significantly tax-raising budget in order to keep borrowing within her rules, see the national debt fall as a proportion of national income, and crucially, a tangible increase of the buffer in the public finances against economic shocks. The central revenue raiser is expected to be income tax, but not via a manifesto-busting rise in tax rates. Instead, by a two-year extension of the cash freeze on tax thresholds, which could create around 1 million extra taxpayers and up to 800,000 new higher-rate taxpayers and raise around £8 billion a year. The Chancellor says she will not return Britain back to austerity, nor lose control of public spending, which signals that there will also be some form of cuts indicated today. Squaring the need to raise revenue, promote growth, soothe the markets, alleviate cost of living challenges and keep backbenchers happy is a tricky ask. Number 11, however, is confident this budget will show it's starting bold tax reforms often shirked by other governments.
The Conservatives say the budget is a result of political weakness rather than economic necessity. With his assessment of the scale of the task facing the Chancellor, here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
This is a difficult budget at a difficult time for a government facing spiralling unpopularity and challenges from the left and right. Nervous Labour MPs, many of whom blame the Chancellor for their predicament, have been invited into Downing Street this week for fireside chats with her. Some have been reassured by what they say will be a budget focused on the cost of living. There will be an extension to the freeze in fuel duty, alongside an increase to the minimum wage and the removal of the two-child limit on benefits. Official analysis is expected to show poorer households will gain the most. But others are worried about the necessary painful choices the Chancellor says she must make. Those choices could determine not just her own fate, but that of her party, as attention will quickly turn to tricky elections in Scotland, Wales and on English local councils next May.
President Trump has said discussions to end the war in Ukraine have made tremendous progress and only a few points of disagreement remain to be settled. A leaked recording, which appears to show his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, advising a Russian official how to get on the president's good side, has been dismissed by Mr. Trump as a standard form of negotiation. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
a 28-point American peace plan that was heavily favourable to Russia has since been amended to accommodate more of Ukraine's demands. And next week, Steve Witkoff is due to travel to Moscow in the hope of persuading Vladimir Putin to sign on to it. That mission may have been complicated by a report from the Bloomberg news agency in which Mr. Witkoff appears to be coaching a Russian official on how to get on Donald Trump's good side, using flattery and praising his recent ceasefire agreement in Gaza. Given Ukraine's lingering concerns about the details of a US peace deal, such reports only threaten to fuel a sense of mistrust, and President Zelensky is seeking a White House meeting to discuss details with President Trump.
Taiwan's President Lai Ching-te has warned that China is stepping up its military preparations to take the island by force. He said Taiwan would introduce a supplementary defence budget worth the equivalent of about £30 billion to underscore its determination to protect itself. China, which considers the island part of its territory, has accused Taiwan of squandering funds that could be used to improve people's livelihoods. A general strike in Belgium is expected to cause widespread disruption. Workers are protesting against the government's plans for reducing the national debt. Our Europe correspondent Nick Beek reports from Brussels.
Today is the culmination of 3 days of coordinated action. Transport staff walked out on Monday. Public sector employees, including some teachers and nurses, followed yesterday. And now, hundreds of other workers, including in the private sector, are joining in. Unions have condemned planned changes to VAT, unemployment benefits and pensions. But ministers say the proposals are the only way to fix the nation's finances. Belgium has the fourth highest level of debt in relation to the size of the economy in the EU, behind only Greece, Italy and France.
The US computer maker HP says it will cut as many as 6,000 jobs, about 10% of its global workforce, as part of a pivot towards artificial intelligence. The firm said AI would boost product development and improve customer satisfaction. A survey suggests the number of puffins on a famous seabird colony off the coast of Northumberland has fallen by almost a quarter over the past year. The National Trust, which looks after the Farne Islands, says it's too early to be too alarmed. Here's our North of England correspondent, Fiona Trott.
Come rain or shine, National Trust rangers can spend hours lying in the dirt, delving deep inside puffin burrows to count the endangered species. The latest figures show the number of breeding pairs recorded on the Farne Islands last year fell from just over 50,000 to 38,500, a drop of 23%. While the decrease is concerning, the charity says, counting puffins is a complex task, with survey conditions, environmental factors and puffin behaviour all influencing the outcome.
Fiona Trott reporting.
Chris, thanks very much. And at 6:07, let's get our first look at the weather this morning with Simon King, who is at the BBC Weather Centre for us. Morning, Simon.
Good morning, Emma. Yes, we've got a pretty cold and frosty start for the day across many areas. Temperatures have been down to -3 to -5 degrees. But for most of us, we'll start off with a bit of sunshine. It's in southwest England, Wales, the Midlands, northwest and northeast England, though, that while there is some sunshine to start off, the cloud is already increasing across western areas. And actually, temperatures are already starting to rise here as well. So frost-free in the far west of Wales and southwest England. That cloud will continue to move its way eastward. It'll bring some rain with it as well, eventually coming into these western areas by lunchtime, and then by later on this afternoon, all parts will be under some areas of rain that could be a little bit heavy in places. Maximum temperatures 6 or 7 degrees across the Midlands, northeast England, but 10 to 12 degrees further west. For eastern and southeast England, again, yeah, pretty cold and frosty this morning. Some patches of mist and fog that should clear away. There'll be lots of sunshine actually, but we'll eventually see some cloud moving its way in later this afternoon, temperatures of 6 to 8 degrees. And for eastern Scotland, pretty similar, pretty cold and frosty again this morning. The cloud increasing quite quickly though through this morning, some rain arriving after lunch, highs of 6 or 7 degrees. And then finally, for Northern Ireland, southwest and northern Scotland, it's mostly frost-free actually because the mild air has already arrived. It means that we start off with a lot of cloud, patches of rain in Northern Ireland, gradually spreading its way into all parts through this morning. Rain eventually clears from Northern Ireland this afternoon, so getting drier here, but temperatures 7 to 12 Celsius.
Thanks very much, Simon. It is 9 minutes past six. Time for a quick look at first look at the papers. Finally, it's here. As you might expect, today's papers focus heavily on the budget. The Eye calls it a moment of truth for Rachel Reeves. The Guardian says it will be decisive for Labour. The Daily Mail says the Chancellor has been warned that her inflation-busting hike to the minimum wage threatens to push even more young people out of work. The Daily Mail's words there. Help is at hand, is the Daily Mirror's view. Its editorial says the increase won't fix everything, but it does show what happens when a government values workers instead of exploiting them.
The Daily Telegraph says the Chancellor would introduce what the Tories have called a dirty dozen tax hikes. The paper says she'll use her speech this afternoon, the Chancellor, to argue the expected increases are, quote, essential if the NHS and other vital public services are to be protected. The Financial Times says Rachel Reeves is hoping the package will reassure the markets that she has the public finances under control.
Some of the papers use their editorials to frame the budget as bad for savers, pensioners and workers, and good for those on benefits. The Sun says, amid this endless picking of ordinary people's pockets, the Chancellor has found another £15 billion to fund more benefits handouts for the jobless. The Mail says Labour has officially become the party of the benefits class. The Times expects a Labour budget for Labour MPs.
The Economist magazine says predictions are pointing to a budget that plugs the fiscal gap with a patchwork of small tax rises and keeps Labour backbenchers content with spending promises. But it warns while such a package might be sufficient to steady the ship, it is likely to steer the government straight into even rougher seas ahead.
The Daily Express uses its coverage to warn against taxing pensioners. It says 500,000 more will have to pay if the Chancellor extends a freeze on income tax thresholds for another 2 years. The Daily Star says the Chancellor will extend the sugar tax to cover milkshakes. Reeves' shakedown is the headline. Not to let a pun go to waste, the paper adds. I'm sorry about this one. She's on shaky ground.
Yeah, that's fine with us. We'll go with it. It's budget. Last bit of budget speculation and we'll have more. But very educated insights, of course, as well to come. It's 11 minutes past six.
The Russia-Ukraine war may not be over by the US Thanksgiving holiday this Thursday for non-American listeners, but President Trump is still driving the negotiations onward. His 28-point plan, slimmed down, it seems, by Ukraine and Europe to a 19-point plan. His special envoy, Steve Witkoff, being sent to Moscow. His Secretary of the Army to Kiev. Let's talk to James Waterhouse in the Ukrainian capital. James, tremendous progress is the words of the president, but presumably some still serious points of disagreement, or at least areas where detail, a lot of it, is required.
I think that's exactly right, Johnny. At the moment, I mean, when we have these diplomatic upticks as to how this war, how on earth this war could finally pause, I think we have to just take it day by day. I mean, you're right. Donald Trump yesterday really was banging the drum of optimism, saying there is progress. He was sending out his army secretary to Ukraine, his senior envoy, Steve Witkoff, who is now having to operate after the leaking of a recording between himself and his Russian counterpart, where he was sort of coaching him on how to best deal with Donald Trump, to shower him with praise and how to sort of draw up this pro-Russian initial peace proposal. Yesterday, we saw some very delicate language from the Ukrainians, the latest being that there is now a shared understanding. But there is now, I think, a constant theme starting to emerge that the stickiest of issues need to be discussed on a presidential level. There are reports here that Zelensky is keen to get to the US to discuss these with Donald Trump. But we saw in a online post last night that he said, you know, I look forward to meeting, said Mr. Trump, Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky soon, but only when these discussions are in its final phase. So what are those issues? Well, it looks to be mainly around not just the recognition of occupied territories, but perhaps Ukraine having to hand over more. So these are incredibly difficult compromises for Ukraine, and it's not clear whether, despite the rhetoric, how we are further along as to how on earth these could be ironed through. But nevertheless, the White House is throwing everything, the most we've seen, I think, in terms of trying to keep momentum.
James, thank you very much indeed. James Waterhouse there, our correspondent in Ukraine.
It's 14 minutes past six. He campaigned for 6 long years to try to have his wife freed from prison in Iran. Now Richard Ratcliffe, husband of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, has intervened in another case of a British couple being imprisoned in the same notorious Iranian jail as his wife, Evin Prison, urging the government to increase its efforts to free Lindsay and Craig Foreman. They were detained in January whilst on a motorbike trip from Europe to Australia. Later we will hear from Lindsay's son, but first let's talk to Caroline Hawley, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, who's been talking to Richard Ratcliffe. Caroline, what has Richard been telling you, and what sort of intervention is he urging?
Well, he thinks the government should do more. He also thinks that the government should have a new policy on state hostage taking. And he's been in touch with the family of Lindsay and Craig Foreman, and he feels very strongly, and he said he feels a little bit triggered because the family of Lindsay and Craig are finding it difficult with the government. They think the government should be doing more. Joe Bennett is getting increasingly frustrated with the government's handling of it. He said that the family and shouldn't have to mount public campaigns and do things like what Richard do, go on hunger strikes to get the government to take cases like this seriously. And he asked the government to communicate transparently with the family about a strategy to get them home.
Because in terms of what we understand around the holding of these two individuals, Lindsay and Craig, what do we know? And based on what happened with Nazanin, you know, and several foreign secretaries later, have we developed how we interact with Iran to have effect?
Look, it's really difficult, but the Foreign Office is saying each case is different. But if I just tell you a bit about this couple, they're in their early 50s. As you said, they were on a motorbike journey from Europe to Australia. Lindsay is a life coach, and she is asking questions along the way to people about what it means to live a good life. And she was going to present her findings at a conference in Australia on positive psychology. So that was very much the vibe of the visit, experience different cultures, meeting people, finding their humanity. And they knew that by crossing into Iran, they were going against Foreign Office advice, but they were posting about how happy they were to be there, how hospitable people were. But it does appear that those questions that Lindsay was asking got them into trouble, that somehow they're being accused of trying to engineer regime change, which is what Nazanin was accused of. So they have been accused of espionage, but they've not been convicted. And there have been several court hearings, but no verdict. And the legal system there is very, very opaque. And what Joe Bennett and the family are saying, which is backed up by MPs from the a parliamentary group that's working on state hostage taking, is that it's much easier to get a positive outcome before any conviction. So that's why there's this push now, because, as I said, the family are waiting anxiously to see what happens. But very, very hard to read what is actually going on in Iran. And the fear is that Iran will want something in return for any release. That is the pattern.
That is the pattern,
because
indeed.
It's picked up a lot of foreign nationals, and they've always usually been released in return for something.
Caroline Hawley, BBC's diplomatic correspondent, thank you. And as I said, we'll be hearing from Joe, Lindsay's son, a bit later in the programme.
18 minutes past six, and businesses are waiting to see what the budget will mean for them. They already know the minimum wage will rise for all workers, 18 to 20-year-olds, seeing an increase of 8.5%. Sean Farrington has more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
Hiya, Johnny. Yeah, the government has said its goal is to eventually scrap this separate rate for 18 to 20-year-olds, have one rate for all adults. So a lot of numbers here, take from it what you want, but the hourly rate for over 21s will rise by 50 pence to £12.71. So that's a 4.1% increase. Workers aged 18 to 20 will see that 8.5% Johnny mentioned there. So that's an 85p rise to £10.85. There were bigger rises last year when we had the announcements about all of this, all on the back of recommendations from the Low Pay Commission. Jonathan Lawson is the chief executive of Butcombe Group, which owns 120 pubs in the UK. Jonathan, morning. What does this mean for you?
Good morning, Sean. Well, I think it gives us some further planning and thinking to do at quite short notice. Butcombe Group is a growing business. We've grown substantially over the last 5 or 6 years. We've acquired over 50 pubs. We employ more than twice as many people now than we did in 2019. Over 20% of those are under the age of 21. We really like employing younger people, progressing them, training them, developing them. But I think the latest increase at that level is on top of a 55% increase in the last 5 years. So from a business perspective, we always want to employ more people. We always want to grow and invest. We think a calmer approach from the government would help us do that. And I do think some of the comments from Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, around wishing to help around cost of living should be seen in light of the youth unemployment rate, which at 15.3% is three times the average for the adult population as a total.
Given your keenness, Jonathan, to employ younger adults and to have such a large proportion of your staff being between 18 and 20 years old, will this change the dynamics of that? Will it change your approach?
Well, I think it just has to make us more prudent in terms of when we're looking at recruitment and where we're looking at investment. We have to look very hard at that. The payroll cost for our business is the single largest cost we have within our P&L. People are the most important part of our business. We're a people business. That's what delivers our customer experience. We want to employ more young people, and we're keen to help be part of that growth strategy that the government talks about. But there has to be a balance and some to that strategy. And it has to be combined with other measures that the government has promised, including the reform of business rates. We are one of the most heavily taxed sectors in the UK, despite being one of the largest employers. So I think balance and stability is things that I and other business leaders are very keen to see at the moment.
When you speak with your staff, would they be able to cope if the rises weren't as big as they are, given the amount that we've seen prices go up more generally? We're talking very recently about food prices rising ever faster once again.
I think that you know, for a father who's got three children under the age of between 20 and 25, the rate of pay for young people is something that I'm very aware of, both as an employer and as a father. But what's particularly important for me and for our younger teams is the progression, the development and the training that we're able to put into their careers. That's what I was interested in when I started as a trainee over 30 years ago, which makes me sound very old. But I think, again, I would point about when Rachel Reeves talks about cost of living, the budget that she set out last October was inflationary. The increases that she put through a national insurance and national minimum wage put through over £2 million of cost into our business very quickly. We don't want to put our prices up for customers, but at a point in time, there is nowhere left to go. And she drove inflation into all elements of the supply chain. That's why we're seeing levels of food inflation that we're currently seeing.
What do the minimum wage increases mean for the pay levels of the staff higher up the career ladder within your business? And does it change the approach of some of your workers because of those changes?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. We always have to balance that. And that's another element of where I would say there is indirect consequences from the actions that the government takes. Because if you are looking at an 8.5% increase for people up to the age of 21, and then a 4.1% increase for national living wage, etc., when you're sitting above that level, then you have every reasonable expectation to say, well, is my level of increase going to be similar and in kind? And we have to balance that very carefully, because we want to be a progressive business, invest into the business and grow the business. And that's the responsibility we have to our employees as well.
Jonathan, thank you. Jonathan Lawson, Chief Executive of Buckham Group. Lindsay James is Investment Strategist at Quilter. Lindsay, how does the UK sit when we compare to our peers around the world when it comes to the levels of our minimum wage and the amount that businesses like Jonathan's are sort of having to see an increase in minimum wages?
If we compare the UK to the US, for example, the minimum wage there that's set at the federal level is $7.25 an hour, so significantly lower Now, certain states have much higher minimum wages, but they are still lower than what's on offer in the UK. So we do offer a very generous minimum wage compared to other developed countries. And I think another issue is the fact that the minimum wage at this level is a salary of £26,500. That's bumping up against graduate salaries. Graduates are, of course, asking to be put aside 3 years of their life and significant amounts of money to study as well. So there's a question mark there for me over whether that commitment will continue.
Lindsay, more broadly, investors, whether they're investing in British businesses or in that bond market, which I'll talk about in more detail in an hour's time, about lending money and effectively setting an interest rate for the UK government to borrow. What are investors keeping an eye out for today?
They're looking for a budget that makes sure that the government can commit to its ongoing interest payments around its significant levels of debt. So they're focused on whether the tax rises are going to be upfront, so early on in this parliament, whether they're deliverable, or whether they sound a little bit like vague promises. We saw gilt yield spike when we heard that income tax was no longer in the government's sights. So that's a sign that we want to see something that's very concrete, that is very achievable. But gilt yields are at the lower end of their range where they have been at this year. So I think the likelihood is more that they could rise than they could fall from this point.
And one of the huge array of things that we've seen reported in recent days and weeks, Bloomberg and The Times picking up that there might be an announcement around a three-year stamp duty holiday for new listings on the London Stock Exchange. What difference might that make, do you think?
Well, it's limited because, first of all, it is for new listings only, and it's not clear why that would be a significant incentive for new investors. Of course, anything that makes the UK stock market more attractive relative to global markets is a good thing. However, I don't think they're going far enough with this. Now, the UK is the only market that charges something like stamp duty, a tax on purchasing shares. It's typically only paid by retail investors and pension funds, not by your hedge funds and your high net worth individuals. So it should be looking at something much broader when it comes to reducing that tax if it really wants to incentivize more investment.
Lindsay James from Quilter, thank you very much. Another thing that we've heard a few more details about is England's mayors given powers to impose levies on overnight stays, so enabling those regional authorities to invest more in transport infrastructure and the visitor economy if they want to spend the money in that way. It's an idea the UK's hospitality industry hasn't been too keen on. Russell Imrie is the president of BWH Hotels GB, 230 hotels throughout England, Scotland, Wales. Russell, morning to you. The impact you think on your business right across the country if these kicked in England? You know, we see sort of similar powers in Scotland and Wales as well.
Good morning, Sean. Yes. Such an additional visitor levy, or let's be honest, it's a tax on visitors, is a highly negative step. The tax is going to be applied to all visitors, not just tourists. It's often referred to as a tourist tax, but it's not just tourists. So UK customers on family weekend breaks, visiting friends and family, or staying in accommodation to facilitate a hospital appointment will all be subject to this additional levy. The UK already has the highest level of hospitality VAT in Europe, so this additional tax will just make hotels even less competitive. All other countries which levy a tourist tax have lower levels of VAT.
Russia.
Therefore, the total charge on the customer is still less, even with the tourist tax.
I spoke a little earlier to Kim Sides, who's the executive director of construction for BAM UK and Ireland, so they have built lots of big infrastructure projects. She was talking about how it could positively impact businesses a little more broadly.
If that money is raised and spent in those communities, that is something that gives energy not just to the community but to businesses around it. That is a good self-fulfilling element of taxation that can be very powerful.
So you might see, Russell, some areas of England decide to put this in place and invest it in infrastructure, and your businesses may see a benefit from that.
Well, it's important to remember that all hotels throughout the UK operate in a highly competitive environment. Customers can decide whether to go to London, York, Paris, Frankfurt for any type of stay. And if the total taxation rate, which includes VAT and a visitor levy, is substantially more than European competitors, it just makes hotels in the UK less competitive, drives down sales, and the reduced volume doesn't have an impact on creating revenue for areas of England.
Russell, thank you for your time this morning. Russell Imrie there, president of BWH Hotels GB. So that's got the best Western hotels in that group, 230 of them across the country. After seven, I'll be looking in a bit more detail about what the bond market, those investors who set that interest rate effectively for the UK government borrowing, are thinking about today.
Sure, we will await. It is 29 minutes past six. Carthy's just joined us with the sports news. Morning, Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. We had Gianfranco Zola on the programme yesterday, and we discussed the two 18-year-olds that could make a difference in last night's Champions League game between Chelsea and Barcelona, and both Chelsea's Estevao and Barcelona's Lamine Yamal played their parts, but it was Chelsea who came away with an excellent 3-0 win. The BBC's senior football reporter Ian Dennis has the details.
An impressive and significant victory for Chelsea with an accomplished performance. It might have been different had Ferran Torres not squandered an early chance as Barcelona failed to score for the first time in 2 years in the Champions League. But even before Ronald Araujo was sent off before half-time, Chelsea were in control. They were creating chances and had two goals disallowed before Cucurella set up a stumbling Koundé to concede an own goal. Another goal disallowed after half-time, and then Estevao with an outstanding finish, fine footwork, blistering effort into the roof of the net. Delap scored a third after a VAR check as Chelsea were looking to cut loose, and they go into Sunday's top-of-the-table clash with Arsenal full of confidence.
Pep Guardiola admitted that he made too many changes on his 100th game in charge of Manchester City. Guardiola gambled with 10 changes to his starting lineup, and City lost 2-0 to Bayer Leverkusen.
Yeah, too many changes. What I said always, I believe that in long seasons, every two days, everybody has to involve, but maybe it was too much seeing the result. I think they play to don't make a mistake, and still to play to do what you have to do, to don't punish the team. You are not free, you are not relaxed, but not just with the ball, without the ball. We are close, but not aggressive enough, and they are a really, really good team.
And Newcastle lost 2-1 to Marseille in the Champions League, but the Newcastle manager, Eddie Howe, is hoping for some positives from that result.
Well, it leaves us a little bit bruised right this second, but we'll come back. We've got some great games ahead. This competition was never going to be straightforward for us. It was never going to be plain sailing. It's the elite competition it is, because you're going to be challenged and stretched, and it will make us a better team for all these experiences.
Motherwell moved level on points with Hibernian and Rangers in the Scottish Premiership after Motherwell had a 2-0 win over Hibs, who were down to 10 men. And in the Championship, Coventry City have moved 10 points clear at the top of the table after defeating Middlesbrough 4-2 on what was a very busy night.
Thanks very much, Carthy.
This winter, cricket's oldest rivalry is reignited.
Bowl him! Bowl him first ball!
England and Australia do battle to compete for the Ashes.
That is extraordinary!
Hear live ball-by-ball commentary on Five Sports Extra and get analysis and reaction of every day's play with the Test Match Special podcast.
The stump's out of the ground!
Test Match Special at the Ashes. Listen on BBC Sounds.
There you go. It is now 28 minutes to seven. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Emma Barnett. And now a summary of the news from Chris Aldridge.
Rachel Reeves is expected to use her budget today to extend a freeze on income tax thresholds until 2030. The measure would be one of the Chancellor's main ways of raising revenue as she tries to meet her rules on controlling borrowing. Ms Reeves says she will not return Britain back to austerity nor lose control of public spending, but that she will push ahead with the biggest drive for growth in a generation. The Conservatives say the budget is a result of political weakness rather than economic necessity. President Trump has said discussions to end the war in Ukraine have made tremendous progress and only a few points of disagreement remain to be settled. A leaked recording, which appears to show his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, advising a Russian official to use flattery to get on the president's good side, has been dismissed by Mr. Trump as a standard form of negotiation. Taiwan has announced plans for new military spending to counter what it says is the intensifying threat from China, which considers the island a part of its territory. The Taiwanese government says the package will be worth $40 billion, or about £30 billion. Beijing has accused Taiwan of squandering funds that could be used to improve livelihoods. A general strike in Belgium is expected to cause widespread disruption today. No flights are scheduled to take off from the country's biggest airport, and some domestic trains and Eurostar services have been cancelled. Workers are protesting against government austerity plans aimed at reducing the national debt. A survey suggests the number of puffins on the Farne Islands off Northumberland has fallen by almost a quarter over the past year, to about 38,500. The National Trust says counting the birds is complex, with survey conditions, environmental factors and puffin behaviour all influencing the outcome.
We will get to that. Chris, thank you very much. It's 26 minutes to seven. But first, the day has dawned, a day to seal the Chancellor's fate, but also perhaps the whole of this Labour government. It really is that big of a landmark moment. It's Budget Day. Henry Zeffman, our Chief Political Correspondent, is here. What can we say as of this morning? Because the speculation, it's safe to say, has been high, even with the Chancellor engaging with it.
Yeah, I think no one in government is pretending that the run-up to this budget has gone quite as they would have hoped and planned. I think we can say taxes are going to go up. That bit of Rachel Reeves's early morning speech a few weeks ago does still stand. But we can also say that they are not going to raise a bulk of that portion of tax through income tax after all. Turned out last week that's not going to happen. What there's going to be is there's going to be a freeze on the thresholds, which means that more people will be dragged into paying higher rates of tax over the coming years. And then what has for some reason in Westminster come to be known as the smorgasbord, which is to say an array of other taxes on lots of different things, each of which will add up to raising the amount of money that Rachel Reeves wants to raise, crucially in order to build herself a much bigger buffer, that's the so-called headroom, than she did last year.
I mean, in terms of the importance of this and how quickly the government will know whether it's, in inverted commas, worked or not on a number of levels, economic and politically, what can we say of that?
Well, there's a few different audiences, and I think the time frames over which the impact of this budget will play out vary depending on the audience. I mean, actually, speaking to people in government yesterday, I detected a sort of slightly unusual mix of nervousness and quiet confidence. The nervousness is about the markets, yes, still. There's someone I was speaking to, very senior in government yesterday, who was just a little bit anxious that the markets might not like what they hear today, even if so many of us do think that the bulk of what we're going to hear today is already in the public domain. The quiet confidence, though, is about Labour MPs. Because, look, from what we know of this budget, a lot of it is very appealing to the sort of median Labour MP. In particular, the abolition of the two-child benefit cap, that is something that Labour MPs across the ideological spectrum of the Labour Party have craved for some time. They believe that is a crucial tool for alleviating child poverty. Worth remembering, though, of course, that last year's budget delivered also distinctively Labour choices that a non-Labour Chancellor would not have taken. That was very popular with Labour MPs. And here Rachel Reeves is, just a year and a bit on, fighting for her political life.
And that fight, just how dramatic is that potentially?
Well, I think it's indivisible from all the things we've been talking about over the last few weeks about Sir Keir Starmer's political fortunes. They're not necessarily close and long-standing friends, but they have spent the last several years as firm political allies. They are tied together. So his leadership being questioned means that her economic judgments and the political consequences of them over the last few years, or last couple of years, are also being questioned, and kind of vice versa. And Keir Starmer has been heavily involved in this budget, perhaps more so than he was in last year's. So, yeah, it's very real. This government is, if you look at the polls, very unpopular. And the people I know who look at the polls most right now are Labour MPs.
Just finally, Henry, you're outside at number 11 this morning. Any rabbits expected to be pulled out of the hat? Any further hints?
Well, you never really know with these budgets. I think the rabbit was probably meant to be not increasing income tax after all, but that one leaked to the Financial Times. But look, I'm sure Rachel Reeves will want to cast the budget in a different light to how it has been cast for her by this sort of patchwork of speculation over the last few days, weeks and months. So it'll be very interesting to see how she does that.
Henry, I'm sure we'll be hearing from you throughout the day across the BBC as we keep you up to date with the budget. Henry Zeffman, our Chief Political Correspondent, thank you.
22 minutes to 7. Last year, it was business that bore the brunt of the very hefty tax rises in the budget. £25 billion hit on employers through national insurance contributions that not one business has forgotten. The costs keep coming. Yesterday, a minimum wage rise for next April, with younger workers in particular seeing a big hike, 8.5%, costs that are expected to hurt the hospitality sector. It fulfils a Labour manifesto promise to shrink the gap between the over and under 21. Simon Jacks, our business editor. Simon, budget day, business hopes and fears?
Well, as you say, they're still licking their wounds from bearing the brunt of the tax rises last year, and we're hoping very dearly that they are not in the firing line today. Please don't clobber us again, was the message I got when I was with business leaders earlier this week. Having said that, as you say, there are some rises in the national living wage. Now, they're less bothered about the 4.1% that the over 21s are going to get. That's roughly in line with inflation. They were kind of expecting that number. More worries, particularly in hospitality, as you heard from the person talking to Sean earlier about the 8.5% rise for the 18 to 20-year-olds. That, remember, that's on top of a 16% rise for 18 to 20-year-olds last year. A disincentive to take on younger people who are some of the fastest growing of the people not in the workforce, perhaps. And also, particularly with this employment rights bill coming down the road. But for business, a carrot, I think, for business rates, trying to make some of the discounts we've seen in the post-pandemic era more permanent by something called the multiplier. And also, the other big money raiser is this idea of the salary sacrifice. Now, a lot of big companies use this. It's the amount of money you give up of your salary to see that money you give up pop straight in your pension without you or your employer paying tax or national insurance on it. Now, it's hard to argue that capping that is not a hit to working people and businesses. So the businesses aren't coming away unscathed, neither are working people. And remember, the biggest measure, of course, is this freezing of the national of the income tax threshold. This was a measure she rejected last time around as a hit to working people. That's going to do the lion's share of the lifting. But in all of this, the silver lining, I would say, is what she'll say, and expect her to mention this, is that the big things that help businesses and the economy, things like inflation and interest rates, are going in the right direction. They're going down. I expect her to mention that today.
Simon, everyone has a sort of favourite number or table or graph that they look for when the budget comes out. What's yours?
I suppose the two things. One will be the overall amount of tax raising. Last time it was 40 billion, so keep an eye on that. It'll be somewhere between 30 and 40. I think that the OBR's inflation expectations will be absolutely key, because echoing what Henry was saying, I think the market's on absolutely key audience for this. You've got to keep them happy, as Liz Truss found to her cost. And the minute this book is published this afternoon, keep your eye on the government borrowing costs on the 10-year yield, as it's known, because that will be very important to see whether the markets believe she's got a grip on the public finances and yet can create sustainable growth so they don't get out of hand in the future. So that's the big, if anything, that'd be the screen I'll be watching the minute that book is published.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. Very busy day for Simon Jack, our business editor. You will hear him across BBC Output today.
It's 18 minutes to 7. Taiwan's president has just outlined a $40 billion injection into the defence budget to speed up the purchase of drones and missiles and the building out of a dome-style missile defence shield. If we're talking about finances and money in the UK, we're just having a sense of what's going on in Taiwan. But there's a whole context to get across there. Steve McDonald is the BBC's China correspondent. Steve, tell us a bit more about what's been announced and why, the significance of it.
Yeah, well, this is like an extra £30 billion going into defence spending in Taiwan. And according to Lai Ching-te, Taiwan's leader, this is in response to China speeding up its military preparations to take Taiwan by force. He said that Beijing has been continuing to increase its military drills and so-called grey zone harassment near Taiwan. Now, there are some of these drills going on as we speak off Taiwan. But what the money gets them, amongst other things, and it won't surprise people who've seen how the war has panned out in Ukraine, missiles, drones, and also this so-called T-Dome, I guess an Israel-style advanced anti-missile system or series of systems that they hope will enable Taiwan to fend off an attack from the People's Liberation Army, or at least dissuade them from engaging in one.
And this wider issue that's going on in the region, tell us a bit more about that. What's been happening in the last few days?
Yeah, well, I mean, for example, the US has welcomed this extra spending, but the Chinese government, though, has been saying today that it's going to, well, crush anyone who gets involved in any dispute, military dispute over Taiwan. And this came after Japan said it was going to place its own missiles on an island quite close to Taiwan. Now, on that island, it's also, in the last couple of days, scrambled military jets in response to drones from the mainland going over that island. And so, yeah, tensions are increasing around this. And you know, all along, I suppose everybody's saying that, you know, there should be peace, etc., etc. But everywhere you look, it's increased tension, I'm afraid.
Steve McDonald, BBC's China correspondent, thank you.
16 minutes to 7, and as attempts to reach a peace deal to end the war in Ukraine inch forward, yesterday in Parliament the Prime Minister warned there was a tough road ahead, but he said the UK wouldn't falter in its support for the Ukrainian people. Here's David Cornock.
A lot's happened in the last few days, with President Trump turning up the pressure on Ukraine's President Zelensky to agree a peace deal before the US Thanksgiving holiday tomorrow. But a leaked draft 28-point plan from United States and Russian officials reportedly contained highly controversial suggestions for Ukraine to hand over unoccupied territory and cut the size of its armed forces. The longest-serving MP, the Conservative Sir Edward Lee, wanted the Prime Minister to persuade Donald Trump
that to reward the tyrant bear with land he's already taken is bad enough. But it would be utterly egregious and appalling to allow him, the bear, the ruthless bear, to take land he hasn't even taken yet in Fortress Donbass.
The Prime Minister didn't talk in terms of the Russian bear, but...
The very idea of negotiating land which hasn't been taken in nearly 4 years of a conflict and has cost tens of thousands of lives is so obviously unacceptable that it shouldn't be put forward or seen as a serious proposition.
Since the 28-point plan emerged, what have been called highly productive talks have been held between the US and Ukraine in Geneva. Keir Starmer said he'd spoken to President Zelensky just that morning and would later chair a meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, 36 countries that back Ukraine. The Liberal Democrats' deputy leader, Daisy Cooper, said if this really was the end game, there was just one chance to get it right.
Many of us fear that President Trump is gearing up to betray the rights of Ukrainians. Ukrainians who have fought valiantly in the face of war crimes, torture, and the abduction of thousands of children.
At the start of his statement, Keir Starmer was emphatic the UK would continue to back Ukraine and keep up economic pressure on Russia.
There is only one nation that wants this war, only one nation that launched this illegal invasion, and only one nation that deploys a constant barrage aimed at murdering innocent civilians.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine unites MPs, and Keir Starmer had backing from the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch. But she did want to know,
what is the government's position on reports that Ukraine's territorial integrity is on the table? Because if Putin is seen to emerge stronger from these negotiations, all our potential adversaries will be emboldened.
Keir Starmer told her that any questions about the future of Ukraine must be determined by Ukraine. Throughout the session, several MPs raised the case of Nathan Gill, the ex-leader of Reform UK in Wales, who was sentenced last week to 10.5 years in jail for taking thousands of pounds in pro-Russia bribes. The party's leader, Nigel Farage, wasn't in the chamber, but his deputy, Richard Tice, was. He was heckled noisily as he told MPs that last year he donated a five-figure sum, bought a pickup truck, filled it with first aid supplies and driven it to Ukraine.
And donated it to the brave soldiers of Ukraine. So my support and Reform support for Ukraine has been rock solid, Prime Minister, throughout.
As one MP shouted treachery, Richard Tice went on to call for frozen Russian assets to be used for Ukraine and described President Putin as a vile dictator. But Keir Starmer reckoned Reform should have said it would investigate the Nathan Gill case.
The simple fact is this, you can't be pro-Putin and pro-Ukraine. You have to decide between the two, and Reform is pro-Putin.
MPs across the Commons had also raised the fate of around 20,000 Ukrainian children abducted by Russia. Labour's Rupa Huck wanted the Prime Minister to send a clear message.
That in the just and lasting peace that we all seek, that they are at the centre of all this. And to send a clear and immediate message, as Pink Floyd might have put it, hey, Putin, leave those kids alone.
Keir Starmer didn't put it quite that way, but reckoned everyone shared the sentiment. Kidnapping children as a weapon of war, he said, was disgusting.
That was yesterday in Parliament with David Cornock.
The sound of puffins, I'm reliably told. The puffin population of the Farne Islands off the coast of Northumberland has dropped by almost a quarter from last year. The area attracts puffins for breeding around the UK and numbers have been declining, but a fall like this has had experts scratching their heads. What is going on? Sophia Jackson is Farne Islands National Trust Ranger. Good morning.
Good morning.
What could be behind the drop?
So it's down by 23% since last year. But we still have 38,500 pairs of puffins, so we've still got a lot. So we're urging caution not to judge this on a reflection of just last year. So we're going for long-term data. However, the way we record these is based on puffin density and sample plots, which this year has highlighted that they've changed. So we're going to reassess these every 5 years and hopefully get some accurate data next year, but it's important to look at long-term trends with these birds.
Understood, but have things changed in some way? Should these figures be borne out?
Yes, so they still reflect how many puffins we've got on the Farne Islands. But the environment's so dynamic, so it changes over the years due to sort of soil erosion, storms, just sort of natural changes. So it'll still reflect it, but it's just important we reassess these to get the most accurate result of the puffins on the Farne Islands.
So the overarching reason might be a change of weather or change of conditions?
So yes, the puffins are listed as vulnerable. So they are going down globally. They face a lot of challenges. So it could be a reflection of this as well. So it could be that they are going down too, but we'll get a more accurate number next year.
If you know nothing about puffins apart from you've just heard some sounds there, what should we know? What do those who care for puffins value about them?
So puffins are a small seabird, so they're only about a foot tall, so they're very dinky, but they're such an important marine indicator. So they spend 3 months on land or on the Farne Islands raising their one puffling, and then spend the 9 months at sea before they come back again. So they're really important marine indicator of what's going on around the UK with their population.
And a baby puffin is a puffling, which has just made my morning. Is that right?
It is, yeah. Puffin is called a puffling.
Johnny's looking very
That's
happy about
fabulous.
That.
That's fabulous. Puffling.
It's gorgeous.
It's the best word of the day. Word of the day.
I might have to start referring to my children as that. But it's very, very sweet, even though if we've got this drop. But also just some better news before you leave us. Other seabirds, how are they faring?
So it's a mixed picture here on the Farne Islands. So our Arctic terns, which we're also kind of famous for, which are the ones that will give you a little tap on the head in the summertime when you come and visit, they're up by 26%, which is really good because they were affected hugely by bird flu a couple of years ago. So that's positive news for them. And then we've also got our big, big jumping bird, which is the shag, which is it's up by a huge amount. So that's up by 57%. Birds had a huge drop from 2023 to 2024. They went down by 80%.
Sophia, it's good to see that they're
coming back.
You've taught us puffling and you're going to allow me to say on the Today programme that it's a good year for the shag. So Sophia Jackson, thank you very much indeed. Follow that, Johnny.
You promised us good news and you have brought us good news. I'm going to go with puffling all morning long. When the US published peace proposals to end the Russian war in Ukraine, many in Europe reeled. They were decried as a Russian shopping list. after some pretty intensive negotiations between Ukraine and its European allies and the US, the Ukrainians say they have reached what they call a common understanding of the core terms. European leaders are still cautious. A long way to go, a tough road ahead. It's the Prime Minister's judgment. Donald Trump is more positive. He refers to a few remaining points of disagreement. What Russia makes of the new proposals, we have yet to find out. Ezra Cohen was acting Under Secretary of Defence for Intelligence in the first Trump administration. I asked him whether the US will now pressure Russia to accept these new amendments.
Look, this plan has gone down from over 20 points to now about 19. And I think they're really starting to narrow in on the core issues. And obviously the Russians are also going to have to make a compromise.
Over the last 24 hours, we've seen this story break from the Bloomberg News Service, which obtained a transcript of a conversation between Steve Witkoff and a very senior foreign policy advisor of the Russian president. And it appeared that Steve Witkoff was advising Russia on how to negotiate with President Trump. I mean, almost giving them talking points. Is that, in your eyes, just sort of normal diplomatic practice, or is it something that makes you think perhaps that the conversation is taking the wrong turn?
Look, I think that's being overplayed, that whole story. You know, when you're in negotiation, you build relationships with both sides, especially if you're the mediator, to try to get both sides to yes. I think that's clearly what Steve Witkoff is doing. He wants this to be successful. Part of making this successful is making sure that the Russians are coming into it with the proper state of mind, and that's the state of mind that they need to make a deal.
The president at the moment appears to be dispatching people and leaving his own considerable sort of charismatic role until perhaps a deal is done and he can come in and then oversee a signature. Do you think that if he got involved personally earlier, it might speed things along? It might help progress towards agreement?
He is doing what I think he does best, which is delegate to key members of his team. He's picked good personalities that he thinks fit the various roles that are needed to get this deal done. And, you know, he's going to get involved at the end to make sure that the deal is signed. But, you know, I think right now he's doing what any good president does, which is delegate to members of his team that he trusts.
There still seems to be, to put it politely, a considerable difference between President Trump's idea of how close we are to a deal, a few remaining points of disagreement was his line, and the Europeans, people like President Macron, our own Prime Minister here in the UK, who think that there is, many hundreds of yards between the two sides. How does that get bridged? Do you think they are talking about the same kind of deal?
The Europeans have a very different view of how things should turn out. It doesn't seem now like any of the other three parties are really concerned about the European position. And I think there are a few reasons for that. Primarily, the Europeans' contribution to the war effort, it hasn't been nothing, but it hasn't really come close to the size of the U.S. contribution. And so I think that is obviously weighing very much on President Zelensky, especially when he realizes that political will in the U.S. for continued support to the Ukrainian war effort is quickly diminishing.
May I be blunt or ask you a blunt question? Do the people you know, the Americans that you know working on this, see the Europeans actually as an obstacle to peace in Ukraine?
Ultimately, we will need the Europeans to step up and provide the security guarantees to the Ukrainians. Mm. And they have the strongest incentive to do that. I think that the Europeans were a barrier probably about 6 months ago. I think at this point, though, given the way that the war has developed and the way the politics have shifted in the U.S., the Europeans' ability to disrupt this, you know, nearing peace, at least in the way that the three parties are moving towards now, is very small.
Mr. Cohen, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
BBC Scam Safe Week on Radio 4.
Helping you stay informed in the fight against scams.
Take a closer look at how scams work and how you can protect yourself in Scam Secrets.
There's comedy with me, Leila Navabi, in This Is Your Bank.
And in the food programme, we'll follow an unbelievable case of fraud in the tea industry.
BBC Scam Safe Week.
Across this week on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now let's get the latest on the weather. Here's Simon.
Emma, thank you so much. Good morning. We have got a cold and frosty start across many parts of the UK. And for eastern and southeastern areas of England, a couple of mist and fog patches this morning, which are going to clear away. And there'll be lots of sunshine here, and that will continue into the afternoon, with maximum temperatures getting up to about 6 to 8 degrees Celsius. But for southwest England, Wales, the Midlands, and across northern England, yes, still again, pretty cold and frosty, but clouds starting to move its way in across west Wales and southwest England, bringing higher temperatures as well, but that cloud will move its way further eastward, covering all parts, and eventually there'll be some rain moving its way in, certainly by lunchtime for western parts, and then to all parts really by the afternoon. And maximum temperatures 6 or 7 degrees across the Midlands and northern parts of England, but 10 to 12 degrees further west. Across Scotland and Northern Ireland, quite cloudy this morning in Northern Ireland and western Scotland, some outbreaks of rain here. That cloud is going to move its way eastward today as well. Temperatures 7 to 12 Celsius.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 26th of November. The headlines. Income tax thresholds are expected to be frozen again in the budget, with the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, also promising measures to cut the cost of living. President Trump says US negotiators are making progress in their efforts to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. And Taiwan is boosting its defence spending after warning that China is stepping up plans to take the island by force.
Coming up in the next half hour, Lindsay Foreman should be enjoying the scenery on her cross-the-world motorbike trip with her husband Craig. Instead, she's spending her birthday in an Iranian jail. We'll talk to her son, Joe Bennett, at 7:30. Turner and Constable go head-to-head at the Tate. And is the writing on the wall for trial by jury? The BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is expected to announce a freezing of income tax thresholds in the budget as part of attempts to raise billions of pounds in extra revenue for the Treasury. This would see people being dragged into a higher tax band or paying tax on their income for the first time if they get a pay rise. In 2023, Ms. Reeves criticised the approach, accusing the Conservatives of picking the pockets of working people. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Rachel Reeves will deliver a significantly tax-raising budget in order to keep borrowing within her rules, see the national debt fall as a proportion of national income, and crucially, a tangible increase of the buffer in the public finances against economic shocks. The central revenue raiser is expected to be income tax, but not via a manifesto-busting rise in tax rates. Instead, by a two-year extension of the cash freeze on tax thresholds, which could create around 1 million extra taxpayers and up to 800,000 new higher-rate taxpayers and raise around £8 billion a year. One of the main challenges has been the downgrade in the UK's long-term economic prospects by the official forecaster, the Office for Budget Responsibility. A separate document from the OBR is expected to explain the influence of low investment, the pandemic and Brexit on Britain's long economic hangover from the financial crisis in 2008. A decisive response to these changes is supposed to display determination to markets, which have shown some jitters since the Treasury retreated from the plan to raise tax rates. The Chancellor says she will not return Britain back to austerity, nor lose control of public spending, which signals that there will also be some form of cuts indicated today. Squaring the need to raise revenue, promote growth, soothe the markets, alleviate cost of living challenges and keep backbenchers happy is a tricky ask. Number 11, however, is confident this budget will show it starting bold tax reforms often shirked by other governments.
The Conservatives say the budget is a result of political weakness rather than economic necessity. With his assessment of the scale of the task facing the Chancellor, here's our political correspondent Harry Farley.
This is a difficult budget at a difficult time for a government facing spiralling unpopularity and challenges from the left and right. Nervous Labour MPs, many of whom blame the Chancellor for their predicament, have been invited into Downing Street this week for fireside chats with her. Some have been reassured by what they say will be a budget focused on the cost of living. There will be an extension to the freeze in fuel duty, alongside an increase to the minimum wage and the removal of the two-child limit on benefits. Official analysis is expected to show poorer households will gain the most. But others are worried about the necessary painful choices the Chancellor says she must make. Those choices could determine not just her own fate, but that of her party, as attention will quickly turn to tricky elections in Scotland, Wales and on English local councils next May.
BBC News understands that during the budget, the Chancellor will announce the publication of the government's North Sea strategy. The plan is expected to confirm that ministers will consider relaxing their moratorium on new drilling for oil and gas. The relaxation would apply where it could be argued that new areas are extensions of existing fields. President Trump has said discussions to end the war in Ukraine have made tremendous progress, and only a few points of disagreement remain to be settled. A leaked recording, which appears to show his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, advising a Russian official how to get on the president's good side, has been dismissed by Mr. Trump as a standard form of negotiation. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
A 28-point American peace plan that was heavily favourable to Russia has since been amended to accommodate more of Ukraine's demands. And next week, Steve Witkoff is due to travel to Moscow in the hope of persuading Vladimir Putin to sign on to it. That mission may have been complicated by a report from the Bloomberg news agency in which Mr. Witkoff appears to be coaching a Russian official on how to get on Donald Trump's good side, using flattery and praising his recent ceasefire agreement in Gaza. Given Ukraine's lingering concerns about the details of a US peace deal, such reports only threaten to fuel a sense of mistrust, and President Zelensky is seeking a White House meeting to discuss details with President Trump.
Three people have been arrested in France on suspicion of spying for Russia. Prosecutors say one of those detained was seen putting up pro-Russian propaganda posters on the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. Taiwan's president Lai Ching-te has outlined an increase in defence spending to buy drones, missiles and an advanced missile defence shield. The cost will be equivalent to £30 billion. Taiwan is aiming to have a higher level of military readiness by 2027 to deter China, as our correspondent Stephen McDonnell reports from Beijing.
According to Lai Ching-te, China has been speeding up military preparations to take Taiwan by force. In response, he said his government would speed up its own military advancement. At a press conference in Taipei, Taiwan's leader said that to compromise on China's aggression would only bring war. President Lai said that increased defence spending would be used to acquire missiles, drones and to build sophisticated missile interception systems. While Washington has welcomed Taipei's spending announcement, the Chinese government's Taiwan Affairs Office has pledged to crush all foreign interference in Taiwan.
The US computer maker HP says it will cut as many as 6,000 jobs, about 10% of its global workforce, as part of a pivot towards artificial intelligence. The firm said AI would boost product development and improve customer satisfaction. Councillors in Epping in Essex have agreed to pursue an appeal after the High Court rejected their case to close the Bell Hotel to asylum seekers. Protests have been taking place at the hotel since the summer, with some of the demonstrations turning violent. The Conservative leader of Epping Forest District Council, Chris Whitbread, said residents would not be paying for the legal action to continue.
The cost of the bill will be found from our reserves, and we will be business as usual on other elements. But of course there's a pressure on council tax at the moment because we've got to deal with very difficult circumstances.
A survey suggests the number of puffins on a famous seabird colony off the coast of Northumberland has fallen by almost a quarter over the past year. The number of breeding pairs recorded on the Farne Islands has dropped from about 50,000 to 38,500. The National Trust, which looks after the islands, is warning against getting too worried. It says counting the birds is complex, with survey conditions, environmental factors and puffin behaviour all influencing the outcome. Two police forces are testing a new way to interact with the public, a virtual assistant named Bobby, created using artificial intelligence. It will answer questions based on the same information available to human call handlers. Bobby will be on the beat in areas covered by Thames Valley Police and the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary, as Anjana Gadgil explained.
Bobby will be able to answer frequently asked and non-emergency questions, but can't be used to report crime or as an alternative to a 999 call. The forces involved say it will be an additional communication channel and free up staff to spend more time on emergencies and more complex policing issues. The technology has been tested on 200 people, including groups representing victims of crime, and will always remain as a work in progress to allow the system to be improved and keep up to date with changing legislation and policies.
That's Anjana Gadgil.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's 9 minutes past seven. For those that enjoy chewing over which tax might go up when, then the last couple of months have been very heaven, as the Treasury and allies of the Chancellor have tested the water with different tax rise proposals, reversed themselves, briefed and counter-briefed. So many leaks and briefings have come this year that some of the grown-ups in the room say they've had a real impact on the economy, delaying investment as businesses and individuals look over their shoulders for what might be coming down the road. But the big day is here, and it is the fiscal fundamentals that will drive the day. The need for the government to find more money from taxpayers to maintain spending, increase it in some places, and not borrow any more than it's already said it would, for fear of upsetting those that lend to the UK and keep the wheels spinning. Helen Miller is director of the Institute of Fiscal Studies, one of the premier research groups in this field. Good morning.
Good morning.
Driving this, as I say, is a gap between what we spend and what the government raises. But there is some uncertainty about that, isn't there? Because a chunk of that gap is driven by the forecast from the Office of Budget Responsibility about productivity growth, which we don't know. Is that the first number you will be looking for, that number, to read this budget?
In short, yes. I mean, you're absolutely right. The whole reason we've had speculation about this budget is because people have been expecting the Office of Budget Responsibility to downgrade productivity, but we don't yet know what that'll look like. There are also many other things that go into the forecasts for the economy. This is it's a big job to work out what the economy will look like over the next 5 years. And what it looks like will really be the backdrop to what Rachel Reeves has done on the policy measure. So absolutely, I first want to sort of dig around in the numbers and see what was it that Rachel Reeves was handed by the OBR? What was it that she was trying to respond to? Was it as bad as some feared, where she had a 10, 20 billion pound hole? Was it better? Was it worse?
There are sort of three big levers here, aren't there? There's tax raising, there's spending, which we broadly know about, the spending is set, and there's borrowing. When it comes to people who lend to us, your green budget, your sort of preparatory document, says they will be looking for a credible attempt to reduce spending. You write of tax rises. The signal is crucial, the message that the budget sends. Is it possible to get that signal now, or do you think the opportunity has been lost in the months of briefings that have preceded it?
Well, I think today is the time to send that signal, because today is when you stop the talk and you actually say what you're going to do. I mean, I think everyone now expects that Rachel Reeves will stick to her fiscal rules. It would be a huge shock if she didn't do that. So that is, I think, nailed on. Mm. But the kind of two unknowns still in that respect are, will she give herself more wiggle room against those fiscal rules? People expect yes, but again, how much more wiggle room? The markets will be looking carefully at that. And will she borrow more overall, or will she stick to her previous plans? The people who lend the government money basically want to know how much the government plans to borrow. And the government have been pitch rolling for the idea that they won't borrow more. So again, The surprise to look out for today is, will they stick to that, or will they actually do some more borrowing?
What is pretty clear, in fact, I think it's probably iron clear now, is that we're not going to get a raise in any of the big taxes, the big four taxes. I think we can be clear about corporation tax, income tax, national insurance and VAT. Instead, we'll get a spray of small measures. Is there any kind of good or bad value attached to raising money through smaller measures rather than saying, right, we're going to get rid of VAT exemptions, for example?
Yeah. I mean, the devil is all in the detail. There are small rises or small changes you can do that would be good, and there are ones that you can do that would be particularly bad for growth. To give you an example, there's the much talked about now potential mansion tax, so a new tax on high value properties. In principle, if you want to tax people with higher wealth, taxing property is a relatively efficient way to do that. But the way they're going to do it looks like we'll have a new bolt on, a new tax that comes on top, and a very bizarre situation where we revalue properties and use those values for one tax, but not for council tax. So again, you know, it could be good in principle, but you're doing it in a particularly complex way. I think that theme of devil's in the detail will run across all of those smaller measures that we see today.
And what is so surprising about the briefing and counter-briefing is actually how small bore it is. There is actually very little big strategic discussion, is there, about the challenges facing governments now and governments to come when it comes to the shape of spending and tax raising?
Absolutely. People have talked a lot about why all the speculation is damaging. And I think it is damaging for a couple of reasons. One is the reason that people have talked about, that individuals and businesses hold back on their decisions when they're not sure what the government's going to do, and that's bad for the economy. But it also takes up a huge amount of bandwidth. So like you said, we could have been here talking about what would be a good vision for the design of the tax system, how to deal with pressures to do with disability or special educational needs or public sector productivity, or, you know, the list could go on. Mm. Instead, because of this combination of Rachel Reeves had no wiggle room against her rules and she'd really tied her hands on the tax measures, we've been scrabbling around speculating about little bits of tax that maybe raised half a billion here or there that are really small beer that I think are getting an outsized share of the debate just because of the kind of political setup. So I think it has taken up a lot of bandwidth that could have been better spent elsewhere.
Helen Miller from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, thank you very much indeed. You can hear extended coverage of the budget in a special edition of The World at One today, starting sharp at 18 minutes past 12, going all the way till 2 o'clock, presented by Sarah Montague here on Radio 4 on BBC Sounds.
Definitely. We'll be looking forward to that. I like the punctuality there. It's going to be good.
12:18.
Only on Radio 4. We will also be looking ahead just after 8 o'clock with our economics editor and political editor as we look at both angles of that and also how perhaps it may affect you. But at 7:15, let's turn our attention to Ukraine. President Trump says he's sending his envoy, Steve Witkoff, to meet President Putin in Moscow in the hope of finalising the peace plan for Ukraine that Washington has drafted, which he says has now been fine-tuned. Diplomats have been spending their latest days thrashing out revisions after Kyiv was reportedly left deeply unhappy that the plan favoured Russia. But now officials in Moscow have said that they will not party to the amendments. Have a listen to this. Speaking to reporters on Air Force One, President Trump said he had no issue with his special envoy prepping the Russians on how to negotiate with him.
That's a standard thing, you know, because he's got to sell this to Ukraine. He's got to sell Ukraine to Russia. That's what a deal maker does. You got to say, look, they want this. You've got to convince them with this. You know, that's a very standard form of negotiation. I haven't heard it, but I heard it was standard negotiation. And I would imagine he's saying the same thing to Ukraine, because each party has to give and take.
What is the response in Russia to this fine-tuning, as it's been described? Steve Rosenberg is the BBC's Russian editor. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
What do we know of the fine-tuning, if anything, and what's the response in Russia?
We don't know much. We don't know what's been taken out of the draft, what's in the draft. The Russians aren't saying much at all. I mean, words are silver, silence is golden, the Russians like to say. And that applies, among other things, to peace plans and peace talks. There is a clear reluctance on the part of the Russian authorities to say much, anything at all, about what is happening now. I think out of concern that could derail what is happening behind the scenes. And that is why you hear the Kremlin criticising what it calls megaphone diplomacy. Yesterday, President Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, he wouldn't provide any detail about the surprise talks in Abu Dhabi between Russian and American officials. It was the same with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. At a press conference yesterday in Moscow that I went along to, he indicated that Moscow hadn't been sent an updated draft of the US peace plan after the US-Ukrainian talks in Geneva at the weekend. So I said, well, how could that be if Russia and America were already holding face-to-face talks in Abu Dhabi?
but Mr. Lavrov declined to say anything about the Abu Dhabi talks, wouldn't confirm them, and then railed against leaks and idle chatter, end of story. So clearly it's a critical time, important meetings, important conversations taking place that could decide whether Russia's war in Ukraine ends, how it ends, or whether it continues.
Is there a sense of what has possibly happened, or the influence of this fine-tuning from Europe and the feeling in Russia on that? Because, you know, this sense that it was going one way last week and now it's a different way. What's the view of that?
Yes. I mean, silence is golden does not apply when it comes to Russia criticising Europe. And all the news bulletins here, all the political talk shows on Russian television are full of reports and pundits and commentators laying into Europe, the European Union and Britain, sort of accusing European leaders of trying to torpedo, that's the word you often hear, torpedo Donald Trump's peace efforts, and presenting European governments as weak, pointing out also that talk of alternative European peace plans for Ukraine hasn't come to much, and also claiming that the US administration doesn't have much time or patience with Europe right now. And that suits the Kremlin just fine, because I think sidelining Europe, weakening Europe, has been a Russian goal. Moscow views European governments as an obstacle to Russia ending the war on terms beneficial to Russia and also to getting on with developing relations with the United States.
And in terms of any feeling around whether this is close to being in some way over, of course, how over ends up looking is what needs to be decided upon, and we don't yet know. But what is that feeling in the country, in Russia at the moment?
We simply don't know. I mean, judging by the silence or the quiet, the reluctance of Kremlin officials to say very much about this, something is happening. And I think the Kremlin feels probably that there is a chance that a deal could be struck that benefits Russia. But things are so sensitive at the moment. And you mentioned that Steve Witkoff is due to come to Moscow next week with other senior U.S. officials, according to Yuri Ushakov, President Putin's foreign policy advisor. So the next few days will be critical. But as I say, we don't know what's in the latest draft of the peace plan, and we don't know if Russia would sign it.
Lots of don't knows, but important to know what we don't know at this stage. Steve Rosenberg, thank you.
7:20, alongside voters and her party, the Chancellor will also be addressing investors in the bond market later today. Sean's back with more on what they'll be looking out for, Sean.
Yeah, so these bond investors, they take a view on the prospects of the UK economy and its finances, effectively setting that interest rate the government pays when it borrows. More than 8% of all government spending is on servicing that national debt. If we look at, say, the 10-year government bond, for example, or a gilt, as you hear it called here in the UK, the effective cost of borrowing for 10 years for the UK government is about 4.5% this morning. April LaRousse is head of investment specialists at Insight, one of the UK's biggest bond managers, £600 billion under management there. April, morning, what will you be looking out for, listening out for today?
We want to see some sort of combination of, obviously there will be some tax changes, but importantly, those spending cuts. And the reason why is if you continually increase taxes, there are growth implications, which of course will lead to more borrowing. And we've already got quite a lot of borrowing on the books as it stands, as you quoted in your high levels of interest service costs. So we just need to see a path where they're actually going to deal with some of the spending.
Are you expecting to see that path, given all the conversations we've had in the run-up?
Yes, but it'll probably be bitty, as was indicated by your earlier commentator. It's probably not going to be focused on one particular area. It'll be lots of smaller measures. But yes, we do think we'll see something. And, you know, importantly, they have to figure out how to get some more of that all-important fiscal headroom. Something like 15 to 20 billion would be much better than a rather small 10 billion, which is what we have currently.
Does bittiness or a smorgasbord or whatever you want to call people are calling what the array of policy changes might be, does that bring its own risks rather than one big policy that might make a big move?
Well, I'm not not sure it's riskier. It just takes a little bit longer for the markets to get their head around and kind of work through the various implications, because, of course, one big thing is sort of easier to quantify than lots of little things. But at this stage, we just need to see a move in the right direction on spending.
Is there a move that, you know, could be on the cards, do you think, that actually would give investors more confidence, a lot more confidence than maybe they've had in recent months?
From the spending perspective?
Mm.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing that was most going to be move the needle the most would be some sort of welfare reform. But we just don't think you're going to see any wholesale changes there. There might be small changes at the margin. So I think it is very hard to imagine what other things might be on the roster, but it's unlikely to be the single most biggest area of spending, which is welfare.
April LaRousse, Head of Investment Specialists at Insight. Thank you very much.
It's 23 minutes past seven.
And we're going to talk about what is described as Fire and Water. That is the upcoming exhibition in at the Tate Britain, which is going to be about J.M.W. Turner and John Constable. They were born around 250 years ago. Well, 250 and 251 years ago. And so the time has come to bring together these two titans of British art and to discuss the way that they have influenced each other. And we're joined by Amy Conklin, who is the curator of the exhibition. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we just talk about why you have brought them together and what you hope to bring out of the proximity, literal proximity, of the two artists?
Well, as you mentioned there, this is a really special moment. It's their 250th anniversaries. So it's time to look again at these two most famous and beloved British artists who many people think are so different that they were not around at the same time. And that really compelled me to explore, well, you know, what did they make of landscape painting, and what was the basis of that fire and water comparison that was made of them in their own day?
Why fire and water? They had an influence on each other. They met, didn't they, at dinner? Sort of early 19th century? And what, did they not get on? Is this where fire and water comes from, or is it about the painting styles that they adopted?
We've got very little to go off when it comes to their, you know, relationship with one another. There's just, you know, Constable wrote many letters which survived, so we know much more from his side. And actually at that dinner, Constable described Turner as uncouth, but having a wonderful range of mind. So I think he could respect the man that he would kind of go on to rival. But the fire and water comparison, that was that comes from a quote made at the time when, in 1831, Constable effectively curated the competition between them. He put his own work between two blazing works by Turner, and the critics went wild and described it as fire, Turner, and water, Constable.
Is there a space in the exhibition that sort of makes you catch your breath, where you have two of their pictures together and you think this is the moment where things become clear as to their artistic relationship?
That's a really great question. There are a few moments in the exhibition which I think I've been surprised by. You know, when you see the pictures in real life, they're so much more powerful than they are in digital format or in books. But I do think that, you know, the root of the exhibition was that moment when Constable put Salisbury Cathedral next to Turner's Caligula's Palace. And these two paintings really epitomise the differences between them and the different things that they made of landscape.
And it's important to note, this isn't just about sort of bringing well-loved pictures and throwing them together as well. There will be pictures in the exhibition that haven't been seen in this country for decades and decades.
Absolutely. I mean, partly because it's a special moment, it's their anniversary exhibition, and partly because this, you know, I wanted to show the very best of what both of them were capable of. There are many things that the public won't have seen for a long, long time, if ever. One of the highlights is a painting that hasn't been exhibited in public since Turner last exhibited it in 1836. So that's a real treat.
Amy, thank you so much for sharing that with us. There's some artistic news well away from the budget there. Amy Concannon, curator of Turner and Constable, Rivals and Originals. That'll be at the Tate Britain on the shores of the Thames here in London.
It's 27 minutes past seven. Karthi has returned with more sports news. Hello, Karthi.
Hello, thank you very much. No budget news here. It's all about the Champions League. Chelsea beat Barcelona 3-0, but both Manchester City and Newcastle lost their matches last night. The BBC commentator, Conor McNamara, joins us to dissect last night's football. Morning, Conor. That 3-0 win over Barcelona, how impressive were Chelsea? How impressive was their 18-year-old, Esteban?
Yeah, what a statement win this was for Chelsea. Barcelona did play all of the second half with 10 men, but all the same, Chelsea were so dominant. And Estevao continues to emerge as simply a boy wonder. He's now scored in each of his first three starts in the Champions League. Last night was billed sort of him against the Barcelona prodigy Lamine Yamal, and he absolutely outshone the Spaniard. In a World Cup year, the Brazilian looks set to take 2026 by storm. And Chelsea, who finished last season very strongly, remember they won the Europa Conference League, they won the Club World Cup in America. They're really getting their act together this season too, and I wouldn't say it's been by stealth, it's been more out in the open than that, but all the same, Chelsea have quietly been going about their business. They're now Arsenal's closest rival at the top of the Premier League, and it's going to be very interesting when those two, Chelsea and Arsenal, meet in the Premier League this coming Sunday.
And what you just said about Chelsea makes what's happening at Manchester City even more interesting. You were doing commentary of their defeat, 2-0 defeat to Bayer Leverkusen. The City manager, Pep Guardiola, admitted his own failings, saying he made too many changes. How much was that the issue, or were they just being outplayed?
I think one led to the other. Guardiola made 10 changes. He was quick to admit that was too many. The dysfunction caused just sort of, you know, wholesale alterations. It meant that City were stagnant. Goal machine Erling Haaland only came on as a second half sub. He's now gone two games in a row this season without scoring for the first time this campaign. Of course, they're over-relying on him. Leverkusen have been a really interesting story. They appointed the former Manchester United boss Erik ten Hag in the summer. That was a disaster. If you think his time at Old Trafford was poor, I mean, he only lasted three games in charge of Leverkusen, but they've bounced back really impressively. They've appointed Kasper Hjulmand as the new boss. He's got the team playing again, and there's no doubt that the heroics at the Etihad has been his most impressive result in his 2 months in the job so far. But City's defeat, their first at home in either the group or league phase of the Champions League since 2018.
And just briefly to round up last night, Newcastle United defeated again, 2-1 by Marseille. They seemed to change their preparations a bit. They went early, they made an aggressive start, but they did lose. Their away form is quite different to their home form. Are there any particular reasons for that?
So frustrating, and yet again on the road for Eddie Howe's team. Harvey Barnes scored both goals in the win over Manchester City on Saturday. That's at home. He put Newcastle ahead after just 6 minutes away in the south of France. But a familiar name from the Premier League in the past, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, scored both Marseille goals to turn things around. I think this season, Karthi, in essence, there's been two Newcastle United teams. The home side, which claimed some big scalps. The away team, which really struggles to retain leads. And last night was the third away game in a row that Newcastle took the early lead, went in front, but then ended up losing the match. And in the last 7 months now, Newcastle have only had a grand total of one away victory across all competitions.
All very interesting. Conor McNamara, thank you very much. Lots more tonight. Arsenal host Bayern Munich in the Champions League. Liverpool face PSV and Tottenham are away at Champions League holders Paris Saint-Germain. A lot of football. In the next hour, though, we will hear from the most successful sailor in Olympic history, Sir Ben Ainslie, on how his Emirates GBR team is preparing for the SailGP Grand Final. And he gave me a bit of a behind-the-scenes tour of their F50 catamaran factory, which included me going in their race simulator.
Oh, wow! Oh, I can actually see that it's on the foils.
There you go.
That's very exciting. The simulator, the machine, is actually showing that I've gone... I mean, it looks like you're floating. Am I turning the wrong way?
Kind of at that angle of death, we call it.
Spoiler alert, it does not go very well after that.
Oh, the angle of death. It sounds great. Thanks, Karthi. Tonight at 8 here on Radio 4, it's The Moral Maze, so let's hear more from Michael Burke.
The BBC Reith Lectures amount to a call to arms for a moral revolution. The Dutch historian Rutger Bregman sees America like the fall of Rome, ruled by a modern-day Caligula. Europe, not much better, sinking into irrelevance. The right is corrupt, the left pathetic. Well, discuss. Nearly all politicians claim to be moral agents, but where in their contrasting worldviews are the values that really matter today? Which part of the political spectrum has the moral high ground? The Moral Maze, after the news at 8 tonight.
Thank you for that. Looking forward to it as ever. The weather, what can I tell you? Cloud and spells of rain will spread eastwards, which will turn heavy in places.
28 minutes to 8. Lindsay Foreman should be enjoying the scenery on her across-the-world motorbike trip with her husband, Craig. Instead, she is spending her birthday in an Iranian jail. We'll talk to her son, Joe Bennett, after the headlines.
We will indeed. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Johnny Diamond. It's 28 minutes to 8, and now a summary of the news with Chris Aldridge.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is preparing to deliver a budget in which she's likely to extend a freeze on income tax thresholds until 2030. She's promised to keep a tight grip on the country's finances, protect record investment in the NHS, and push ahead with the biggest drive for growth in a generation. The Conservatives say the budget is a result of political weakness rather than economic necessity. President Trump has said discussions to end the war in Ukraine have made tremendous progress and only a few points of disagreement remain to be settled. A leaked recording which appears to show his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, advising a Russian official to use flattery to get on the president's good side, has been dismissed by Mr. Trump as a standard form of negotiation. Taiwan has announced plans for new military spending to counter what it says is the intensifying threat from China, which considers the island a part of its territory. The Taiwanese government says the package will be worth $40 billion, or about £30 billion. Beijing has accused Taiwan of squandering funds that could be used to improve livelihoods. Councillors in Epping and Essex have agreed to press on with an appeal after the High Court rejected their case to close the Bell Hotel to asylum seekers. Members of Epping Forest District Council reached their decision at a meeting last night after receiving legal advice. The computer maker HP says it will cut as many as 6,000 jobs, about 10% of its workforce, by 2028 as it pivots towards artificial intelligence to boost efficiency. The company said AI would help product development and improve customer satisfaction. And the UK's first artificial intelligence virtual police assistant is to begin answering non-emergency questions. The technology, known as Bobby, has been developed by the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary and Thames Valley Police.
Chris, thank you. 26 minutes to 8. Tomorrow will be Lindsay Foreman's birthday. Instead of being free to enjoy it and out on the road with her husband Craig and travelling around the world as planned, the British motorcyclist will be spending the day in Iran's notorious Evin prison, locked up separately from Craig, as we understand it. The couple, in their early 50s from East Sussex, were detained in January by Iranian authorities, accused of asking questions of locals that could prompt regime change. The couple have appeared in court several times but not been officially tried or convicted. Beyond that, the family remain in the dark. Now, a sadly seasoned campaigner in this field, Richard Ratcliffe, husband of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who spent 6 long years in prison in Iran, and Richard was campaigning during that time to have her freed, and some of it, I should say, in the same notorious prison where Craig and Lindsay are right now. Richard has now called for the government to increase its efforts to have them freed and returned home. Joe Bennett is the son of Lindsay Foreman. He joins us now. Good morning.
Morning.
How are they? What is the latest that you have from them?
Yeah, they're doing okay. I mean, when I say okay, they're coping, right? And it's tough. I mean, recently, in the most recent weeks, we've heard that they're both been on hunger strike. I'm, you know, glad to say that they've both stopped that, but that is a serious, serious cry out for help to put themselves through more of an ordeal than they're already suffering, just to be heard, really, and get what was promised to them. As you said at the top of the show, it's my mum's birthday tomorrow. It's a tremendously difficult time for us, but especially for her. She's going to be alone in her cell. I'm not even sure if she'll be able to call home or speak to anybody, which is, it's pretty heartbreaking, to be honest with you.
And I mean, this has been the whole of the year now. We've spoken several times throughout the year, and from the point of view of what the government, our government, is doing for you, is it enough?
Honestly, I don't think it is. You know, I mean, we're slowly starting to see things happening. So, for example, post-hunger strike, they have now been able to call home and speak to other family members, apart from myself, which is a massive boost for the both of them. But, you know, I know my mum, I can hear the tone in her voice is changing. There's a tiredness to it. She's scared. And you know, we've been hearing the same thing from the government that we heard 10 months ago, until most recently, actually, because they have changed, and a spokesperson from the Foreign Office has changed their statement. And that's the first time in 10 months that has been changed.
to what, I mean, I have one in front of me saying we're deeply concerned by reports that Craig and Lindsay Foreman have been charged with espionage. We continue to raise this case directly with the Iranian authorities. And the foreign UK Foreign Commonwealth Development Office are providing them with consular assistance and remain in close contact with their family members.
So, look, the latest that I've got is the government takes all allegations of human rights violations, including that detention that may be arbitrary, very seriously and raises concerns with local authorities where appropriate. The assistance we can provide depends on the individual circumstances of the case and the local conditions. The impact and influence we can have will not always be the same. So that's definitely different, but it's also, in my eyes, you know, they're talking about arbitrary detention there. So there has to be a little bit of a shift in belief as to what is actually going on.
Because right now your mum and her partner have not been charged or have been charged?
They've not been charged. So, you know, the court process itself, the judicial process that they call it, isn't justice. You know, there's an outcome that feels that was written before the, you know, yes, the curtain even went up. There's no defence. There's no transparency, no logic. You know, it doesn't feel like law, right? It feels to me like leverage. But when you're asked to see their defence sheet, for example, we've requested that multiple times and it's not given. You know, they've been in multiple court cases. It is just being dragged on. You know, there seems to be no end. Speaking to my mum recently, she has no idea, neither does Craig, as to what the next step is. And, you know, you can't respect something that doesn't exist, you know.
How much does it matter to you and to your family that Richard Radcliffe has urged for the government to do more, and specifically around, that you know, this sort of stealing of people?
Yeah, massively important. You know, to be honest, Richard Nazanin have been, and others have been absolutely fantastic in supporting the family. And I think I said to you when we first spoke, the one thing that really triggered alarm bells for me is the fact the government didn't want us to speak to these people and offer that support. So for him to come out and, you know, speak vocally is massive for us. But it's also, there's a lot of similarities that's happening with the two cases of my mum and Nazanin. You know, there's this willingness to sort of allow a false process to unfold. It doesn't really feel right at all.
Are you trying to learn from Richard and all he had to do and go through? You know, he had to become a campaigner over those 6 years of another magnitude.
Yeah, I mean, what he did, he was amazing. As I say, he's sort of the staple point, and you try to take inspiration because it does show that things can work out in the end. But I would have hoped that the UK government would have learned from previous experience. And what we can't afford is for this to drag on for 5-6 years. It's, you know, almost a year already, and it's a year too long.
And it's your mum's birthday tomorrow, which
it is.
Be.
Yeah, mum's birthday tomorrow. She would have been 53. She'll be 53 tomorrow. I'm really hoping that she can call home. You know, as I say, I spoke to her recently, and on the 3-minute call that I got, I had to wish her happy birthday early. It is an incredibly tough time. You know, it's the little things that we'd used to do. It would be the little text messages that we send and the laughs that we'd have together, the plans that we'd make, have all been robbed, as has their freedom.
Joe Bennett, son of Lindsay Foreman, thinking about her tomorrow as it'll be her birthday, and also locked up separately, but in the same place, as we understand it, with her husband, Craig Foreman. Thank you.
It's 19 minutes to 8.
Looking now to social media and the particular network where a lot of people promote themselves professionally, let me ask you this. Does it pay to be a man? Well, you may think you know the answer to that question in other ways, but specifically on LinkedIn, some of its female users have been experimenting with changing their gender in their biographies to male and giving themselves male names, and whether that has boosted their visibility. LinkedIn, like most social networks, works off algorithms that prioritise certain information over others. And even though LinkedIn deny that this would be a ranking signal, that gender, changing your gender should won't affect how your content appears in a search or a feed. Anecdotally, these women, some of them, have been reporting that it has. And brilliantly, we were learning the word puffling in the last hour. Let's talk about bro coding and what's been going on with certain posts. To explain all, we can rely upon Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor. And in a moment, I'll speak to Labour MP Samantha Niblett, founder of the Labour Women in Technology Group. But first to you, Zoe. Get to bro coding in a moment. Tell us about this experiment. Anecdotally, what's been found?
It's really interesting, this, Emma. I've been watching it for quite a while now, and that's a growing number of women commenting that their posts on LinkedIn just don't seem to be getting visibility. So one woman, she's an entrepreneur. She's very high profile. She's called Cindy Gallup. She's got 140,000 followers on LinkedIn. And she says she shared a post which was viewed 401 times, which just seems quite strange, doesn't it? The maths don't quite add up yet. So as you say, some women decided to experiment by changing their gender, making their profiles male, and they said that they saw results. This they called the bro boost. And others said they started using AI or doing it themselves to rewrite their posts using more kind of masculine, business jargony, sort of focused language. And this is called bro coding. And they also said that they noticed that those posts got more invisibility. So what exactly is going on here? Well, LinkedIn has written a blog post in which it denies that its algorithm has, you know, in any way uses gender or age or race as a signal. But it does use hundreds of others, including your job, your industry, who it is that's in your network, and how active you are. And it also says that a lot more people have joined the network in recent months, certainly this year. And so there's just a lot more noise, a lot more content that's vying for that attention. But that doesn't stop these experiences from happening, does it? And more women seem to be noticing that they appear to be. So I spoke to a number of social media consultants who said they didn't think that LinkedIn, which is owned by Microsoft, was in any way deliberately targeting gender. But that doesn't necessarily mean it isn't happening by accident. So one man, he's a social media consultant called Matt Navarro, and he said he thinks maybe, you know, that what happens to a post in its first hour, so how many people see it and engage with it and share it, that dictates how well it floats, if you like, across the rest of the network. So that key first hour is really important. And he's also said, you know, maybe more men have more powerful networks and they're more likely to comment and share each other's posts. So they're kind of fueling that network amongst themselves. I guess it's that sort of boys' network that we might be familiar with, you know. And maybe they just, maybe, you know, what the algorithm is reflecting is something that's actually happening in society, which is men boosting other people's content. What I think is really interesting, Emma, is that a number of the women who tried the bro coding and bro boosting said they didn't like it. They didn't actually enjoy presenting like men and they wanted to go back to being who they actually were on the platform.
Some more caveats, perhaps, and some humane language, as some of them put it, I was noticing. And not just saying, to paraphrase how wonderful they were with imperatives within their language. Samantha Niblett, listening to that, what do you make of this? Because, you know, there are the arguments that go that social media reflects the world we are in.
Well, if it's reflecting the world we are in, then that's something to worry about, I would say. Much like Zoe, it was Cindy's posts on LinkedIn that caught my attention. I am a prolific user of LinkedIn myself and have been for years and really enjoy using the platform. And so I was deeply concerned when I saw that there were women and actually some male allies as well reporting that depending on what language they use, depends on the reach they seem to get. In fairness, when I raised this as a concern on the platform, LinkedIn got in contact with me. And a couple of weeks ago, we had a call. We sort of got very little time to talk about the algorithm challenge. But my pushback to them was, well, if you are saying you are doing the very best you can to improve economic outcomes for everybody, and they say they have about 44 million members in the UK, which is an incredible reach, then they need to perhaps be focusing on outcomes rather than their algorithms. Of course, one of the other challenges we have is the lack of transparency, which we actually see across many social media platforms. We have shadow banning and some words that mean that your post won't be showed to anybody at all. So it is a real challenge, and I am looking forward to LinkedIn basically proving they're not rather than just saying they're not.
Have you tried bro coding your profile?
No, not yet, but I am tempted.
How will it read versus how it does now?
I don't know. I think one of the things I'm incredibly well known for is being incredibly authentic and myself, even when I am quite pushy and forward, whether that translates as bro coding, I am not sure. But it is a concern that if they are not actually directly biased, are they proxy biased? So if they are using industry position activity to feed their algorithms, are they using things that are systemically already inherently male? And then an additional concern that I have is they have this economic graph data, which all the data they've got on their LinkedIn profile, which they're using to advise governments with. Well, if they're advising governments with information that's already deliberately or not deliberately biased, then and governments using that data to base policy on, then that is also a concern.
Thank you to both of you. If you're looking to bro code your profiles or anything you write about yourself, I know Johnny will be, his ears have perked up. You can insert action-oriented online business buzzwords such as drive, transform and accelerate. And that should boost your, profile and popularity.
You seem to have been suggesting that men, and I quote, bang on about how wonderful they are on social media. Is that your experience?
They may not caveat it. Right. They may not caveat it. That might be it.
Okay, that could be it. It's 12 minutes to 8. It's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the Reverend Dr. Michael Banner, Dean and Fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge.
Good morning. Working in a university, hardly a day seems to go by without me engaging in a conversation, often a vexed conversation, about the challenges artificial intelligence poses to traditional learning, teaching and assessment. Difficult though these issues may be, they seem rather trivial besides the prediction that AI could replace 3 million jobs in the UK by 2035, according to a report from the National Foundation for Educational Research. There is some dispute as to which jobs are most at risk. Some think management consultants, legal professionals and psychologists will be the first to be let go. Others think it will be software engineers and machine operators. There is an emerging consensus, however, that wherever the losses occur, they will be substantial, and they will leave a large number of displaced workers and those seeking employment for the first time facing hugely significant challenges in re-entering or entering the workforce. In the book of Genesis, Adam's punishment for listening to Eve and eating the forbidden fruit could be summed up in the phrase, "Get a job." No more swanning about the Garden of Eden, enjoying its abundant produce. Life will now be toilsome, and only by the sweat of his brow will Adam find his daily bread. Leisure is replaced by labour, and it's a curse. Without sharing my precise age, I can less coyly admit that retirement, for me, is not too far over the horizon. And when I talk to contemporaries who are already retired, they are, give or take the odd grumble, mostly glad to have stepped back from the stresses and pressures of work, which often leave us feeling we do not have enough time for husbands, wives, children, parents or friends, let alone for the interests and activities which may be as important or more important to us than what pays the bills. A colleague snapped at me the other day when I was less than immediately helpful about some practical issue that my trouble was that I had my head in the clouds. In facing up to the dual aspects of the contemporary problem of work, that some have too much and others are anxious about having too little or none, I can't help thinking, however, that the most relevant location for the head is definitely in the clouds. Artificial intelligence seems to create a problem, which plainly from another angle is an opportunity. Real human intelligence, imagination and ingenuity, blue sky thinking, is surely what is needed to address this particular situation. Yesterday's Reith lecturer on Radio 4, Rutger Bregman, has written a book entitled Utopia for Realists. Too many voters, he suggests, vote for the sake of some supposedly better past. What we need, however, is to imagine and realise a better future. In the book of Acts, the early church is pictured as having all things in common and sharing with all in need. Head in the cloud stuff. But if we translate that into ideas of universal basic income, a radically different tax regime, and new patterns of shared working, a sense of looming anxiety might just be displaced by a sense of burgeoning possibilities.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Michael Banner, Dean and Fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge. It's now 9 minutes to 8.
Howls of outrage have greeted the suggestion from the government that it might limit jury trials to crimes that have the potential for a sentence of 5 years or more. The idea has been floated by the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, as a response to the huge backlog in Crown Court cases. Jury trials go back a long long way. Being judged by a group of your peers, being seen as a vital check on an overbearing government. But for many years, less serious crimes have been heard by magistrates, and the man charged with finding a solution to that enormous backlog, Sir Brian Leveson, told Radio 4's PM programme yesterday a substantial structural change is needed to fix a justice system at crisis point. To discuss it, I'm joined by Baroness Helena Kennedy, a barrister and Labour peer, and Lord Charles Faulkner, former Justice Secretary, also a Labour peer. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Helena, can I start with you? There is a cut-off for some. I mean, it's a voluntary one, isn't it, that you can opt to have your case heard by a magistrate rather than a Crown Court. Why not take that a bit higher and keep juries simply for the most serious crimes?
Johnny, I'm 95, I can't remember what exactly the number is, but a huge majority of cases are dealt within the magistrates' court, yeah. So let me clear about that. The reason that the system is on its knees is because of the ridiculous ways in which we have underfunded the justice system, because it's not seen as important enough. But one of the greatest strengths of the jury system is actually bigger than just to do with law and cases. It's actually about, in one of the very few ways that the public can participate in our institutions, the public come into the courtroom and they lend themselves to the system, because the judges deal with the law and advise them on the law, and they deal with the facts. They assess whether people are being truthful or not. And it really is a valve on the system. And in every other place, we're destroying trust in our institutions. And I think that having the public engaged in the legal system is one of its vital proponents. It really is. And I think that this is a mistake. And I think there are other things that could be done. For example, I think that we should be introducing suspended prosecutions for many of the low-level things that you could that you would not want the jury system for, particularly, you know, under 12. I think 5 years is much too high. Under 12, if you were going to, sentencing was going to be under 12 months, probably in a case, it doesn't go for jury trial.
Okay.
You would encourage it not to, and you'd do that by saying to people, we're going to suspend the prosecution for 2 years. If you get into trouble in the next 2 years, you will be absolutely descended upon terms of punishment. So that suspended prosecutions is the way to put a scythe through these numbers.
Okay, let me let Charlie Faulkner respond to your point there. A valve, says Helena Kennedy, and a critical valve, a piece of public participation in how we are governed.
That's useful, but it couldn't possibly justify the system as it is at the moment. In order for the criminal justice system to work, people have got to have faith that it's convicting the guilty and acquitting the innocent. And the jury system is not doing that effectively now. First of all, increases in the number of offences, increases in disclosure mean the system, as Brian Leveson has said in his report, just cannot cope. It takes years for a trial to come on now. Defendants game the system. They therefore say, let's plead not guilty and hope the victim and the witnesses go away. And they do. And they get off as a result of that. But the system itself is not fair if it's a jury system. We never get reasons for why somebody has been convicted. Look at the Pistorius case in South Africa. The judge at first instance acquitted him of murder and convicted him effectively of manslaughter and sent him to prison for 3 years. She had to give reasons. It went to an appeal and they identified that he'd committed murder. If you don't have to give reasons, then you get people wrongly acquitted and wrongly convicted. And the jury is not a necessary protection against the overbearing state. It's the judges.
Briefly, Charlie, if the money was there to fully fund the Crown Court system and get rid of these backlogs, would you still be making this argument?
Yes, I would. And Leveson makes it absolutely clear it's not just underfunding. It's also huge burdens of disclosure. The fact that the amount of evidence available for most crimes is so huge now that the jury system is the most inappropriate way of dealing with very many crimes. So it's not just about money, it's also about the system is no longer fair.
Helena Kennedy, other countries manage to have a decent system of justice without having jury trials on the scale that we do. Why is it so important for the functioning of justice?
Listen, the common law is one of the, I happen to believe, is the greatest legal system in the world. It is flexible. It includes the public in its processes as lay magistrates or as jurors. And it's one of the things that retains trust in the system. Increasingly, we're hearing in the public debate that systems are too elitist, you know. And I'm telling you, this will be another brick taken out of the edifices that actually have retained our society's cohesion in the past. Mm. And I really don't think that we're looking at the bigger picture here. We've got a crisis of trust in all of our institutions. And if we're not careful, this one will actually crumble. Judges will have much more focus put on them if they're the people who are making all the decisions. And you will end up having little trust in our judiciary, which at the moment is very, very high.
Briefly, let me bring Charlie Faulkner on that point in particular.
The point of
trust in institutions declining, putting ordinary citizens into them is important.
Trust is the key question. If you have no trust in the criminal justice system to be effective, then people will lose faith in our country as being a country where you can trust the system to protect you against crime. And at the moment, because you can't get tried for years, people have decreasing trust in the system. And the idea that in order to protect that you've got to have juries coming, that does not do the trick.
OK, we will have to leave it there. Baroness Kennedy, Lord Faulkner, thank you very much for joining us.
He had green hair and very bad teeth.
The rise and fall of Sex Pistols.
Join Gina Birch from the Raincoats.
I saw firsthand how their magnetism tore through British culture.
And me, Steve Lamack, as we explore one of Britain's most notorious bands.
Four members, no egos.
That shocked the nation.
They are the antithesis of humankind.
Defined punk and tore themselves apart.
The rise and fall of Sex Pistols.
Search Sex Pistols on BBC Sounds.
It's 2 minutes to eight. Let's get the weather from Simon King.
Johnny, thanks. Good morning. Yeah, pretty cold and frosty out there to start off for many of us, but it is going to turn less cold or milder, actually, as the day goes on from the west, but with it brings some cloud and some rain. So for southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and, of course, northern England, the cloud quickly increasing through this morning. Some patchy rain arriving into Wales, southwest England by lunchtime, and that will move its way further north and eastward as the afternoon goes on. Temperatures about 6 or 7 degrees in northern England and the Midlands, but about 10 to 12 degrees further west. It's an east and south-east England where, cold and frosty this morning. Lots of sunshine, though, and I think we'll keep a lot of sunshine for most of the day. The cloud only increasing by this evening, highs of 6 to 8 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, southwest and northern Scotland, mostly frost-free this morning. Quite a bit of cloud, some patchy rain in Northern Ireland. That will gradually spread its way into western Scotland, becoming a bit drier in Northern Ireland later this afternoon, highs of 7 to 12 degrees. But for eastern Scotland, while frosty this morning, some sunshine initially, but the cloud increasing here. Eventually, I think we'll see some rain moving in from the west during the afternoon, with maximum temperatures here of about 6 or 7 degrees Celsius.
Thanks very much, Simon. Coming up, full coverage of what we know of the budget and what we don't. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Emma Barnett.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 26th of November. The headlines this morning: freezing income tax thresholds until 2030 is expected to be the main revenue-raising measure in the budget. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, insists she will not return to austerity nor lose control of public spending. President Trump says US negotiators are making tremendous progress in their efforts to end the war in Ukraine. And an annual survey suggests the puffin population of the Farne Islands off Northumberland has fallen by almost a quarter.
Coming up in the next hour, after a three-year gap, the show that put Netflix on the map, Stranger Things, is back.
This isn't like one of your campaigns. You don't get to write the ending. Not this time.
Has the wait whetted appetites, or has it lost the iconic show its momentum? I'm sure you'll have some views on that. And Carthy has been to meet Sir Ben Ainslie to get a behind-the-scenes peek at how his team is preparing for the Sail GP Grand Final this weekend.
Everything about this is Formula One. The level of professionalism of the manufacturing processes, the data, the analytics, being able to speak to boats, teams, key personnel anywhere around the world at any moment is very much Formula One.
But first, our Formula One of news, Chris Aldridge.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is expected to announce a freezing of income tax thresholds in the budget as part of attempts to raise billions of pounds in extra revenue for the Treasury. This would see people being dragged into a higher tax band or paying tax on their income for the first time if they get a pay rise. In 2023, Ms Reeves criticised the approach, accusing the Conservatives of picking the pockets of working people. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Rachel Reeves will deliver a significantly tax-raising budget in order to keep borrowing within her rules, see the national debt fall as a proportion of national income, and crucially, a tangible increase of the buffer in the public finances against economic shocks. The central revenue raiser is expected to be income tax, but not via a manifesto-busting rise in tax rates. Instead, by a two-year extension of the cash freeze on tax thresholds, which could create around 1 million extra taxpayers and up to 800,000 new higher-rate taxpayers and raise around £8 billion a year. One of the main challenges has been the downgrade in the UK's long-term economic prospects by the official forecaster, the Office for Budget Responsibility. A separate document from the OBR is expected to explain the influence of low investment, the pandemic and Brexit on Britain's long economic hangover from the financial crisis in 2008. A decisive response to these changes is supposed to display determination to markets, which have shown some jitters since the Treasury retreated from the plan to raise tax rates. The Chancellor says she will not return Britain back to austerity, nor lose control of public spending, which signals that there will also be some form of cuts indicated today. Squaring the need to raise revenue, promote growth, soothe the markets, alleviate cost of living challenges and keep backbenchers happy is a tricky ask. Number 11, however, is confident this budget will show it starting bold tax reforms often shirked by other governments.
The Conservatives say the budget is a result of political weakness rather than economic necessity. With his assessment of the scale of the task facing the Chancellor, here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
This is a difficult budget at a difficult time for a government facing spiralling unpopularity and challenges from the left and right. Nervous Labour MPs, many of whom blame the Chancellor for their predicament, have been invited into Downing Street this week for fireside chats with her. Some have been reassured by what they say will be a budget focused on the cost of living. There will be an extension to the freeze in fuel duty, alongside an increase to the minimum wage and the removal of the two-child limit on benefits. Official analysis is expected to show poorer households will gain the most. But others are worried about the necessary painful choices the Chancellor says she must make. Those choices could determine not just her own fate, but that of her party, as attention will quickly turn to tricky elections in Scotland, Wales and on English local councils next May.
BBC News understands that during the budget, the Chancellor will announce the publication of the government's North Sea strategy. The plan is expected to confirm that ministers will consider relaxing their moratorium on new drilling for oil and gas. The relaxation would apply where it could be argued that new areas are extensions of existing fields. President Trump has said discussions to end the war in Ukraine have made tremendous progress and only a few points of disagreement remain to be settled. A leaked recording which appears to show his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, advising a Russian official how to get on the president's good side has been dismissed by Mr. Trump as a standard form of negotiation. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
A 28-point American peace plan that was heavily favourable to Russia has since been amended to accommodate more of Ukraine's demands. And next week, Steve Witkoff is due to travel to Moscow in the hope of persuading Vladimir Putin to sign on to it. That mission may have been complicated by a report from the Bloomberg news agency in which Mr. Witkoff appears to be coaching a Russian official on how to get on Donald Trump's good side, using flattery and praising his recent ceasefire agreement in Gaza. Given Ukraine's lingering concerns about the details of a US peace deal, such reports only threaten to fuel a sense of mistrust, and President Zelensky is seeking a White House meeting to discuss details with President Trump.
Cuba has condemned the build-up of US military forces in the Caribbean, calling it an exaggerated and aggressive threat to the region. The White House has said the deployment is intended to tackle what it calls narco-terrorists smuggling drugs into America, but Cuba says Washington is using that as a false pretext to overthrow Venezuela's government. Taiwan's President Lai Ching-te has outlined an increase in defence spending to buy drones, missiles and an advanced missile defence shield. The cost will be equivalent to £30 billion. Taiwan is aiming to have a higher level of military readiness by 2027 to deter China, as our correspondent Stephen McDonnell reports from Beijing.
According to Lai Ching-te, China has been speeding up military preparations to take Taiwan by force. In response, he said his government would speed up its own military advancement. At a press conference in Taipei, Taiwan's leader said that to compromise on China's aggression would only bring war. President Lai said that increased defence spending would be used to acquire missiles, drones and to build sophisticated missile interception systems. While Washington has welcomed Taipei's spending announcement, the Chinese government's Taiwan Affairs Office has pledged to crush all foreign interference in Taiwan.
Thailand's government says 33 people are now known to have died in flooding in the southern city of Hat Yai. The conditions have been described as a once-in-300-years event. Almost 3 million people have been affected. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports from Bangkok.
Thailand's fifth largest city is now a water world. Only the tops of the houses are visible in the centre of Hat Yai, with people breaking holes in their roofs to escape the rising brown floodwaters. From the air, families could be seen sitting on them and waving to attract the attention of rescuers. Some had been without food and water for many hours. Volunteers are travelling from all over Thailand to bring flat-bottomed boats to help with the rescue effort. Army and police helicopters have been flying in medical supplies like oxygen to hospitals and flying out patients who need urgent treatment elsewhere. Thailand's south experiences heavy rainfall and flooding almost every year at this time, but the unprecedented volume of water dropped by tropical storms this year has overwhelmed lakes and drainage canals.
Widespread disruption is expected across Belgium in what is the culmination of a three-day general strike. Workers in the public and private sectors have been protesting against planned changes to VAT, unemployment benefits and pensions. The government insists the measures are the only way to reduce the country's national debt. A survey suggests the number of puffins on a famous seabird colony off the coast of Northumberland has fallen by almost a quarter over the past year. The National Trust, which looks after the Farne Islands, says it's too early to be too alarmed. More details from our North of England correspondent, Fiona Trott.
Come rain or shine, National Trust rangers can spend hours lying in the dirt, delving deep inside puffin burrows to count the endangered species. The latest figures show the number of breeding pairs recorded on the Farne Islands last year fell from just over 50,000 to 38,500, a drop of 23%. While the decrease is concerning, the charity says counting puffins is a complex task, with survey conditions, environmental factors and puffin behaviour all influencing the outcome, highlighting the need for consistent long-term data. Before they return, rangers will now work on measures to protect puffins by preventing seals from disturbing their burrows during the breeding season.
Two police forces are testing a new way to interact with the public, a virtual assistant created using artificial intelligence. Bobby, as the technology has been named, will be on the beat in areas covered by Thames Valley Police and the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary. It will answer questions based on the same information available to human call handlers, but can't be used to report a crime or as an alternative to dialing 999 in an emergency.
Chris, thank you very much. It's 8:10. The day has dawned, a day to seal the Chancellor's fate, but also perhaps the whole of this Labour government. It's budget day. And in the run-up to the big reveal, we have seen Rachel Reeves, the first woman to hold the role, engage far more with budget speculation than is usual. Why? Opinion polls suggest this relatively new government is deeply, deeply unpopular, and the Prime Minister and Chancellor even more so. The overarching message from Rachel Reeves has been, and will continue to be, that her budget will get debt down, the cost of living down, and waiting lists down. Income tax thresholds are expected to be frozen again, but still, we await the detail. Will Rachel Reeves' plan work? How will we know? Who will be helped by this budget? Who will be hindered? And at what cost? going to talk this through now with Faisal Islam, our economics editor, who's close to Downing Street, and Chris Mason, our political editor. And Chris, good morning. If I could just start with you and looking at this politically, there is a view, and I'm just going to quote the Times Leader article this morning for some, that this year's budget is best summed up as a Labour budget for Labour MPs, one that will raise taxes, boost public spending and ensure, as the paper puts it, that the state remains as burdensome as ever. How can you reflect on that?
Yeah, morning to you, Emma. I think we shouldn't be wildly surprised that a Labour Chancellor would want to deliver what they would see as a proudly Labour budget. And look, there is no doubt there is taxes going up, what the Conservatives and others are branding as a dirty dozen tax rises coming at lunchtime. And you have a critique from the Conservatives and indeed from Reform about it punishing work and entrepreneurship and rewarding welfare. Liberal Democrats sceptical in the context of a very sluggish economy about the impact of that minimum wage rise, for instance, in potentially squeezing those seeking entry-level jobs. I think from the government's perspective, what we'll get from Rachel Reeves is this emphasis on, as I think she will put it, getting the ongoing cost of living challenges for so many. And then absolutely an attempt to alight upon policies that are popular amongst Labour MPs, because my goodness, at the moment, they need to convince Labour MPs that they're onto something, Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves, so that they're still around when the next budget comes around in 12 months' time. But they would argue also into the perhaps medium term can be popular in the country. Two particular policies just to alight on, just to address that question you put to me, Emma, around the Times Leader. The minimum wage increase likely to be popular amongst many Labour MPs, and then the removal of the two-child cap, yes, which has prevented many families from claiming universal credit or child tax credit for any third or additional children. The evidence suggests that is a big measure for lifting lots of children out of poverty, about 630,000. It is worth saying there is polling that suggests that support for keeping the cap is actually higher, way higher, than for scrapping it. So it's one of those things that is popular amongst many, but not all Labour MPs, but there's a rather different view in the country.
Well, stay with us, Chris. Let me go to Faisal. Good morning.
Morning, Emma.
From that point of view, if we look at how various people within the population, to crassly group people together for a moment, could be affected, there has been a debate, for instance, around that cap, whether it is a better way of lifting thousands out of poverty or we can't afford it and it's not going to be the tool that does that. What can we say about that and also, you know, those who are on the lowest incomes in this country and how they could be affected by this?
On the two-child cap, mathematically, in terms of our measures of poverty, it is probably the most efficient way of lifting people out of that measure. There are other arguments about what it does for people's life chances, but you can see a significant concentration in terms of child poverty of people that have been impacted by the cap, as you'd expect, because literally it doesn't pay out those benefits for the third, fourth child. So that is the argument. It's been strongly put with to government by people like Gordon Brown campaigning on this, and it looks like they're going to act. More generally, in terms of the people that are going to be hit by, and there's two things going on here, and it is quite, it's worth stressing how unusual it is for a Chancellor to use the budget, to use fiscal, so tax and spend and some regulatory measures, to say that the budget will bring down inflation. Indeed, we should be able to see that in the numbers if that is the case. So we can test that immediately, right, when we get the budget numbers. But I think in terms of the revenue raises, it is worth noting, although they're not going to go ahead with the income tax rate increase, if they do go ahead with what we expect, which is the income tax threshold extension, that is a broad-based tax rise that will affect by hundreds of pounds a year everybody that pays tax, and then additionally bring people into the tax system who wouldn't otherwise have been brought in, about 1 million people, and bring about 800,000 people into the higher rate tax system who wouldn't otherwise been. That's a significant change to the tax system. This used to be called a stealth tax. Politicians tend to assume that people notice it less, and so this is why it's been a favoured tool, of course, famously of the Conservatives, who basically raised taxes by $40 billion a year by freezing thresholds at a time of high inflation. Wasn't what they intended, but it was the consequence. So it's worth noting that that could be worth about $8 billion a year, and you're getting up to what would have been the sort of revenue raised by a 1p income tax rate increase across the board. So it is significant. Then on top of that, and we can talk about some of the detail here, you have higher earners, high pensions being affected, potentially those who own significantly highly valued properties. And there's a whole load of other tax rises stretching from tourism taxes to milkshakes. I'm sure some we haven't even been able to preview, despite all of the speculation that has been milling round the foggy Westminster over the past couple of weeks.
Well, those struggling the most in the country feel richer after this?
Well, this is a really interesting question, because if you look at consumer confidence, which, you know, there's a general vibe, obviously, of doldrums and of doom. When you look at the detail of consumer confidence, the feel-good factor, what you notice, somewhat counterintuitively, is that the under-50s, the core of the working population, that their levels of consumer confidence have gone up in some cases to sort of near 10-year highs. Now, I say this and I can hear people say, well, I don't feel that. But it's the older population, retired, who have seen a massive drop off in consumer confidence. And so what we can typify here is that there may have been an impact from rising above inflation incomes that have been seen over the past year. And that the government will try and feed that with things like freezing prescriptions, freezing rail fares, some other policies that we don't know yet, possibly energy bills. But there is a sort of general sort of malaise, and that has translated into maybe mainly older people with savings not spending money. You can see this in the numbers.
Right.
So what another test here is, and it's a big one, can the Chancellor generate some sort of feel-good factor in the economy, both for consumers but also for businesses? And yet there will be some business tax issues as well that they have to face.
And what about the concern, for instance, around the minimum wage pricing people out of work, and the idea that this will hit the business owners and the strivers, as some would describe?
Well, this gets to the dichotomy of a budget that both seeks to and has to raise revenue, given their other plans, but also wants to deal with the cost of living challenges. The Venn diagram of those policies, there's only a couple of places that overlaps. Other than that, they can go in different directions. And the national living wage increase that was confirmed yesterday, 4% on the central measure, obviously on top of a 9.8% increase last year. Clearly, businesses identify this as a reason that inflation has stayed sticky in the UK versus our peers. So, yes, but on the other hand, it has helped the incomes of the low paid. Millions of people have been able to earn more than the inflation rate over the past year, and that will continue over the next year. So there's two sides of the ledger here that I think it's important to focus on. That said, the sheer quantum that we're going to get of tax rises, I don't think it will be as big as last year. But that can't help but affect the consumer. The incidence of taxes eventually fall upon consumers by one way or the other. And so I think it's also important to note that, just looking at the numbers, there has to be a contribution from some sort of spending cut, efficiency saving, squeeze in the latter years of the forecast, which has been less talked about in the run-up. So I'll be very interested to see what that is, how much that lands with backbenchers, and whether it's convincing to the markets, because that's the other audience, of course, that Rachel Reeves wants to communicate to. And we've seen a bit of a roller coaster in the effective rate of interest paid on government debt over the past few weeks. It was going in their direction, but it popped up a bit after that sort of stepping back from the income tax rate rise. So they'll be watching that very carefully indeed. And I think the increase in the buffer around the funds required for meeting their borrowing rules, what we call headroom, will be a key number to watch today. It's 10 billion, which was seen as very tight. It's led to this sort of roller coaster, hamster wheel of constant tax speculation. Another test will be, can they put that to an end with a significant increase in headroom?
Thank you so much for that, Faisal Islam, our economics editor. Busy day for you. Chris Mason, just to come back to you as our political man, as it were, we just heard words roller coaster and bringing things to an end. How serious is this a day in terms of the political lives of the Chancellor and the Prime Minister? And I ask that because of these deeply low polls in terms of popularity, but also how things have been going in the run-up to this. You know, I was just rereading an interview the Chancellor gave at the weekend to the papers, talking, I'm sick of people mansplaining things to me. It's been pretty unpleasant and difficult at times for Rachel Reeves, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really bumpy this last couple of months, no doubt about it. The kind of wobbly indecision in plain sight is near impossible for Labour MPs to defend. This was always a landmark moment. In fact, speaking to folk back in the summer, they saw two landmark moments today, and then those elections in May to the parliaments in Wales and Scotland and many English local authorities. That so central a concern was how this budget would go down. We saw that bubbling up of concern from those loyal to the Prime Minister a couple of weeks ago, fearing that if it tanked, there might be some challenge to his leadership. So an absolutely keen awareness of how key this is, because they know, the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, that they themselves are deeply unpopular and that they currently lead a deeply unpopular government. And that unpopularity in the first instance includes many Labour MPs who would love to see them succeed, but fear at the moment that they are not, and are feeling the heat of this. This is the middle of the end, one Labour MP said to me yesterday, suggesting that this would be Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves' last budget. Another said they were on a four-year walk to the guillotine, a reference to the next general election and the prospect of losing. So that's the mood that they confront just within the postcode, let alone in the country.
Chris Mason, our political editor, Faisal Islam, our economics editor, thank you very much indeed. And just to say, of course, we don't know yet what we... well, we do know what we don't know, but we don't know any of the details. So the extended coverage of the budget is in a special edition of The World at One today, starting sharp at 12.18 and running until 2, presented by Sarah Montague.
Set your alarm, 12.18. Right now, it's 22 minutes past 8. Tremendous progress with a fine-tuned deal and only a few remaining points of disagreement. President Trump's thoughts there on the renegotiated peace plan for Ukraine. The original 28-point plan, decried variously as a Russian shopping list or appeasement, has undergone some surgery at the hands of the Ukrainians and their European allies. Ukraine now speaks of having reached a common understanding, and President Trump is sending envoys to Russia and to Ukraine to try and maintain momentum. But just how acceptable might any deal be to Ukrainians? Alexei Goncharenko is a Ukrainian opposition MP for the Black Sea city of Odessa. Good morning.
Good morning.
The original deal, the 28-point plan, seemed rammed full of things that Ukraine could never agree with. Now the talk is of a common understanding. The core of the deal was land for peace, Ukraine giving up a lot of land that is its in the east. Is that acceptable?
No, it's not. But in general, you know, when we're starting some negotiations, it's hard to imagine and hard to believe that from the beginning the proposal will be absolutely acceptable. For this, we would need, you know, if Ukrainian tanks would be near Moscow, then the peace plan would look completely different, right? But we are where we are. And in this situation, we understand that this peace plan will not be 100% how we see it. But definitely there are some things which are unpleasant but acceptable, but there are things which are unacceptable completely. And the biggest problem with this package of proposals was...
we appear to have lost the MP. You're back. Sorry, sir. Sorry.
Voluntarily.
I'm so sorry, sir. You were just saying the biggest problem was, and we lost you there. If you just go ahead.
Hello?
Mr. Goncharenko, hello. Hello, hello. It's Johnny Diamond in the studio. Yes, we can hear you loud and clear. You were just telling us what the biggest problem was.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. We have problems with electricity in Ukraine, and because of this, mobile connection also is not great.
We understand.
So the biggest problem is this demand to Ukraine to leave voluntarily controlled by Ukraine part of Donbas, Kramatorsk, Slovyansk. It's not just cities, it's also hundreds of thousands of people, and these are heavily fortified cities. So this is something which is unacceptable for us. So I think we need in negotiations to improve this plan. This is our task.
Can we talk about security guarantees? Because they were put into the phrase was in the 28-point plan, but there was very little detail as to what they meant. Is getting more detail about that also important to Ukraine, to know what a security guarantee would look like?
Absolutely. This is a crucial point. It is mentioned in the plan, but it is not clarified what exactly is meant. We in Ukraine here, we are trying.
Oh, we appear to have lost Mr. Goncharenko again, and you can hear there, we're searching. Oh, you're searching for the signal.
Yes.
You can hear, we can hear you again. I'm sorry about the line, and we appreciate you hanging
on
for us.
Yeah, I'm sorry too.
No, that's fine. You were talking about the security guarantees and what you need. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave that one for the moment. That was Alexei Goncharenko. We got the idea there that there is some progress being made towards a compromise of sorts. Let's get the sport with Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. I'll give you the Champions League headlines first. Chelsea had an impressive 3-0 victory over Barcelona with 18-year-old Estevao scoring Chelsea's second goal. Pep Guardiola admitted he made too many changes on his 100th game in charge of Manchester City. They lost 2-0 to Bayer Leverkusen and Newcastle United lost 2-1 to Marseille. There's more Champions League action tonight and there are details on the BBC Sport website. Now, this weekend, the Emirates GBR team is aiming to become the first British team to win the SailGP Grand Final. I went to Southampton before Sir Ben Ainslie, who is the CEO, left for Abu Dhabi and the most successful sailor in Olympic history, and his teammates gave me an idea of what it's like to race on water at 50 kilometres an hour. Well, I'm a few miles off the coast of Southampton. I've come to the SailGP Technologies facility. This is where the F50 boats are built for the SailGP season. And I can see from a little window above the factory fins and foils being built. There's a hub and a cockpit. There's something that looks like the Hadron Collider in the distance and lots of people busily working away. And Sir Ben Ainslie is going to show me around.
Carthy, hey, how are you?
Hello.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming down.
Right, shall I have a look around?
Yeah, let's go and have a look.
We have an array of multicoloured fins, I think they are, in front of us, Ben. What's happening here?
So we're looking at one of the wing sails for the F50 catamarans, which are obviously the boats that we use in SailGP.
I mean, it looks a little bit like the dinosaur, the Natural History Museum. It's enormous.
You've got the main bar of the wing, and then you've got the ribs. And when it's finished, it will have plysar, which is kind of like a plastic that goes over the wing to then catch the force of airflow over the wing. They're probably the most delicate part of the boat.
Right, so we're heading into the machine room now. Interesting smell.
Yeah. So this drill, you can see it's all automated, and it's drilling into, I think that's a bit of titanium, and that part is part of the daggerboard case that's a crucial part of the boat.
Okay, this feels like the heartbeat of what goes on. Where exactly are we, and what are we surrounded by?
Well, we're in one of the control rooms, and the amazing thing about SailGP and their partnership with Oracle and being able to access all of the data that comes off these boats. So you've got people that can be analysing any part of any boat.
It's a bit like being at a Formula One race, this, isn't it?
Absolutely. Everything about this is Formula One. The level of professionalism, of the manufacturing processes, the data, the analytics, being able to speak to boats, teams, key personnel, anywhere around the world at any moment is very much Formula One.
I'm Hannah Mills. I'm the strategist on board the Emirates GBR SailGP team. My role, I stand behind the driver on the boat, and I'm basically the eyes to make sure we don't have any crashes. The driver and everyone else on board are aware of all the other boats on the race course that we need to be aware of strategically as to how to make the next decision.
Well, you're doing that from being the grinder, one of the grinders, which is a strange word, but explain what that means.
So when the wind drops down and it's quite light wind, we're trying to get the boats up on foiling and going as fast as possible. So normally we sail with 6 people on board, and as soon as the wind drops down, we go down to 5 and then we go down to 4. And when we're just 4 people on board, I jump forward into the grinding roles, which are the really physical roles on the boat, basically pulling the big wing sail in.
And congratulations, I know that you have won the Impact League. How important is that to everything that's part of SailGP?
It's massive. Yeah, I honestly got quite emotional when we found out we'd won the Impact League. And for the second year running, the Impact League in SailGP is so innovative, it's so unique in sport in terms of trying to reduce the carbon footprint, trying to do things more efficiently and try new technologies to make things more sustainable. Teams take on each other to try and have the most impact and purpose throughout the season. And so, yeah, we're really proud to win.
Yeah, I'm Dylan Fletcher, the driver of Emirates GBR SailGP.
As someone who isn't regularly on the water, are you able to describe the whole experience to us of what it's like to be on these incredible boats?
So they're 50 foot long, very wide, powered by a big wing sail as you would have on an aeroplane. And then we've got basically foils, which is like an underwater aeroplane wing that lifts the whole boat out of the water when we get to about 30 kilometres an hour.
When you're up on the foils, they glide across the water. It looks incredible. I presume it feels like you're floating or flying.
It does feel like you're flying. The boat's really on a knife edge, and although it sort of looks relatively stable, it's actually definitely not stable on the yacht. It's an incredible job that our flight controller does, Parkinson, and keeping us flying high and fast the whole time.
So, Carpi, we're in the sim room now, which is where a lot of the sailors out behind the scenes are practicing all of the manoeuvres and the different race courses. So we've got Dylan here, who's our driver, and Hannah, who's a strategist. They can talk you through.
This is the most advanced video game I think I've ever seen. It's incredible to look at. It's got computers, screens everywhere. In terms of comparison size-wise, what's this like?
So it's literally a replica of the F-50 hull, the cockpit version of it that we use, and we've got all the exact same wheels, buttons, everything's pretty much exactly the same, other than it's a bit drier than the real world.
Am I allowed to get in this?
Jump in and have a go. We'll press play.
Oh, gosh.
Don't crash. Have a steer around and see.
So I'm scared and it's not even real.
So if you sort of point towards, Spinnaker Tower, that's a good one. There you go. So boat's on the foils now.
Oh, wow. Oh, I can actually see that it's on the foils.
There you go.
That's very exciting. The simulator, the machine, is actually showing that I've gone... I mean, it looks like you're floating. Am I basically turning the opposite way to the way I should be turning?
No, you're kind of fine.
We're kind of at that angle of death, we call it.
Yeah. I love the fact that Ben's just steering with one hand, and I was struggling to do anything with two.
Okay, that's the wing's gone wrong way.
Capsizing.
That looks awful.
It's actually worse than that in real life.
Oh, but it's actually very scary. I'm clearly not cut out for this at all. So I'll just leave it to the experts. Good luck in Abu Dhabi to all of you.
Thanks, Carthy.
Thank you very much.
I was only going at half the speed. They go at 100 kilometres an hour. I was going at 50. So clearly not my forte, but it was a lot of fun.
You sounded like you were having loads of fun. Thank you, Carthy. At 9 this morning, another powerful interview in Life Changing. Let's hear more from Dr. Sian Williams.
My guest this morning wrote to us about experiencing something in her childhood that she buried for most of her life, out of shame and because she didn't feel anyone really believed her. Then, decades after it happened, Jess's sister rang with news that started a years-long battle for justice and transformed everything for her. This is a story of a fight to be seen and heard, and what can shift when you speak up. Life-changing. After the news at 9.
Looking forward to that as ever with Sian. Look now at the weather. Cloud and spells of rain will spread eastwards, which will turn heavy in places.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Johnny Diamond. It's 27 minutes to 9. Let's get a summary of the news from Chris Aldridge.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is expected to use her budget this afternoon to extend a freeze on personal income tax allowances until 2030, a measure that would drag more people into the basic, higher and additional rate brackets as their earnings grow. Ms Reeves has promised to protect record investment in the NHS and push ahead with the biggest drive for growth in a generation, without losing control of public spending. The Kremlin has confirmed that President Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff will visit Moscow next week for talks with Vladimir Putin. They'll discuss an amended peace plan to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. Taiwan says it will spend an additional $40 billion, the equivalent of about £30 billion, on defence, warning that China is stepping up military preparations to take the island by force. The Taiwanese president said the most dangerous scenario was not military action, but giving up. A survey suggests the number of puffins on the Farne Islands off Northumberland has fallen by almost a quarter over the past year, to about 38,500. The National Trust says counting the birds is complex, with survey conditions, environmental factors and puffin behaviour all influencing the outcomes.
Thanks very much, Chris. If those who run the BBC thought that the chairman's appearance before the Culture Select Committee on Monday would end questions about how the corporation is run, they are going to be disappointed. Late last week, Sumit Banerjee resigned from the board of the BBC, its most senior governing body, unhappy, it was said then, at governance issues. Now, BBC News has seen his resignation letter, and it appears to contradict the evidence that the chairman of the corporation, Samir Shah, gave on Monday to the Select Committee. Mr. Banerjee writes that there was not consultation, nor was there adequate discussion of the support or lack of it that the board had in the CEO of the news division, Deborah Turness, who would resign alongside the corporation's director general. The chairman, Samir Shah, said he had a 26-minute call with Mr. Banerjee and that he is surprised and disappointed by the suggestion that Mr. Banerjee was not consulted. Katie Razzle is our media editor. She joins us. Katie, there seems to be a pretty strong difference of interpretation here. Mr. Banerjee says he wasn't consulted. Mr. Shah strongly suggests the opposite. Can they both be right?
Well, Johnny, I suppose it depends on what you mean by consultation, what they mean by consultation. Mr. Banerjee didn't release his letter until the day after MPs on the Culture Committee took evidence from, amongst others, Samir Shah, as you say, the chair. Dr. Shah said various things in that session about Mr. Banerjee. He said his term on the board was up at the end of the year anyway, and Dr. Shah had already told him he didn't want to extend him to another term. He said that he was disappointed and surprised by the abrupt resignation. And yes, he said he had consulted Mr. Banerjee because he spoke to him for 26 minutes on the day of the departure of Tim Davey and Deborah Turness, the day that was announced. Now, it was only after that that Mr. Banerjee decided to send me his letter, and he appears to be contradicting Samir Shah. So in his email to me accompanying the letter, he said he'd followed the discussion at the committee with interest and told me my resignation letter might clarify my reasons for resigning. It might also serve to inform misconceptions that may have arisen for committee members and viewers. So what's in the letter? You were talking about it. Well, he says it was in fact him who instigated the call with Samir Shah. He's also saying he missed one board meeting and then was informed at the next that Deborah Turness, the head of news, had been told that she did not have the confidence of a majority of the board. But Mr. Banerjee writes he was not invited to any meeting where a matter of such importance was to be discussed. And he goes on to say, I will not be seen as a participant in a board decision on which I was not consulted, nor one which, in my view, has had adequate discussion. And he also writes the treatment of Deborah Turness would have been viewed by Tim Davey, the director general, as a direct assault on him, so it's not surprising he resigned. Well, Johnny, there are now quite a lot of competing narratives here, maybe a bit of score settling going on after the BBC was plunged into crisis in recent weeks, because I've been told by an insider that Deborah Turness had already decided to resign herself because she felt the board didn't have her back. That person described the board as a circular firing squad, and in his letter Mr. Banerjee also says the way the board has acted has taught BBC enemies a valuable lesson, as he put it, that a leak and launch strategy can work to destabilise the corporation. He asks, will the departures of two of our most senior, respected and loved executives make the BBC stronger? Somehow I doubt it very much.
I mean, aside from some fairly unhappy reflections on BBC governance, if you accept Mr. Banerjee's version of events, is he suggesting a stitch-up behind the backs of at least one, him, board member, maybe others?
Well, that's how some people will read the letter. That's the issue here. I wanted, you know, I asked him whether he would do an interview. He felt that the letter speaks for itself. So we're going to have to read between the lines. I think it matters, of course, because it puts more pressure on the chair, Samir Shah, who I think came out of Monday's select committee session a little stronger after these very turbulent weeks, even though the head of the committee afterwards questioned on Radio 4 whether the BBC was in safe hands under him. But I think if you look at the letter, it does shed more light on the divisions at the heart of the BBC board. Remember, that's the board that's responsible for oversight and strategy. Now, at the committee hearing on Monday, the three board members appeared at pains to present unity. Sir Robbie Gibb, the member for England, a former BBC executive and one-time Downing Street head of communications under Theresa May, who has been accused by some of plotting a coup, well, he described that as nonsense and deeply offensive. We'd already reported that the board blocked Deborah Turness and the news division from apologising for the Donald Trump edit after the leaked memo was reported by the Telegraph. In his letter, Mr. Banerjee calls that letter, said that letter was predictably leaked. Mr. Banerjee seems to be suggesting the board made Deborah Turness's position untenable. And I think this letter matters. What happens at the top of the BBC matters, because Dr. Shah is still the chair, and given the BBC's prominence, there are going to be other crises. And if the board isn't unified, how can it navigate them in the best interests of everybody who pays the licence fee?
Katie, thank you very much. That was Katie Razzle, our media editor.
20 to 9. What is happening in the artificial intelligence race? NVIDIA, the market leader of AI chips, shares in the company fell sharply on Tuesday amid growing concerns Google is making significant strides in AI, wiping out almost $200 billion in the chipmaker's market value, $200 billion, I should say. Google last week released Gemini 3, its latest large language model, which is considered to have leapfrogged OpenAI's ChatGPT. But what does NVIDIA's share tumbling tell us, share price tumbling, tell us about the wider state of the AI race and how much ground Google is possibly gaining, particularly with Google developing its own chips? How much will this change the overall race and game? And how much does it matter to all of us? Professor Gillian Tett, Provost of King's College, Cambridge, and a columnist at the Financial Times, and Dame Wendy Hall, Regius Professor of Computer Science at the University of Southampton. Morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Gillian, if I could come to you first, what does this tell us then about that race? Why does this matter, this potential repositioning?
Well, I'm not actually a professor, but you don't have to be just one to see what has happened, which is that you've had this explosive... Don't worry, I'm happy to be promoted. I am a doctor, but there you go. We've had this explosive surge of excitement around AI stocks that have pushed up the stock market and the valuation, the share price of tech companies to really quite eye-popping levels. I mean, just to give you a tiny example, if you go back 2 or 3 years, AI-related stocks represented about a quarter of the US stock market. They're now worth about half the stock market. It's quite astonishing what's happened. And essentially what people have been arguing is that so much of this excitement and hype has rested on one or two companies, particularly OpenAI. And people are now asking, does the emperor actually have real clothes or not? Because what's become clear is that everyone's been betting that OpenAI and NVIDIA, the company that creates chips, will dominate this going forward. But anyone with long memories will remember how, say, VHS displayed Betamax all those years ago, or, say, Facebook displayed MySpace in the social media world. So people are asking, well, maybe what is now the front runner is going to be leapfrogged by Google, which has just released a whole new AI model that looks very impressive called Gemini.
And that impressive model, Dame Wendy Hall, to come to you, are you looking at this thinking there might be developments we hadn't expected, or how do you expect this to affect us?
Can I just correct a bit of that? Sorry, Gillian, but you have to, first of all, NVIDIA provides the hardware, OpenAI and Google are about the software. NVIDIA were the only company providing the types of chips, or fast enough chips, for what we wanted. Google have now come out with their tensor processing units, which are a competitor. And we all know that competition's in good. Having a monopoly supplier of the chips was never good. But the actual race... You can talk about whether my bet has always been on Google, not OpenAI. I could tell you why if we had time. But the actual race is between the US and China. And Huawei will be coming out with the new chips. The Chinese government's pouring money into Huawei to produce chips that will no doubt, in typical Chinese fashion, be faster and cheaper in a year or two, maybe less. So that's where the real race is going to be. And but actually, in terms of what's happening with NVIDIA, that shouldn't be connected with the AI crash, so-called crash, because NVIDIA's infrastructure, it's crashing because of competition. The others are crashing because of the overvaluing. But the real race is between the US and China.
Well, I was going to say, I think the critical point is this. I mean, I completely agree with you. We're not disagreeing here at all, that you've got a race going on, or competitive pressures happening around the hardware and around the software. And the US-China race is doubly important. I mean, there's a story up today on the Financial Times showing that China is actually now leading in open source AI models over
well,
the US.
Are.
But the crucial point is, well, the crucial point is this. At the moment, Wall Street analysts and City of London analysts are projecting that the tech sector in America is going to be borrowing around the $1.5 trillion in the next 2 or 3 years to fund a massive explosion in investment and capital expenditure to build data centers. And the reason why markets are nervous is because that borrowing and all that money rushing into the sector is assuming that companies like OpenAI and American tech will be the winner. if it turns out they're not, or if new types of technology essentially make the current framework redundant, people are going to start asking, are we pouring good money after bad by backing all these data centres and chip production?
Wendy, I feel like you wanted to come in that much.
We're not throwing good money after bad. It's good. And I think that there's not going to be an overall winner, not in our life, not in the near term, of the US versus China. I think that they're both producing fantastic new software models, and they'll be producing the infrastructure that's needed to run them. And, you know, at the moment, we don't buy Chinese chips, and they aren't allowed to buy the NVIDIA chips. So we have two separate markets going on here. And the interesting thing is that when they start competing with each other, and there's a lot of geopolitics in that, because at the moment the West won't buy Chinese chips. The West won't buy Chinese chips. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But I think what's happening with Google coming out with their stuff is very, very healthy for our market. And what Gillian said is absolutely right. I mean, investment's pouring into this area, and at the moment there's no real return on that investment except for NVIDIA. There is return on the infrastructure investment. There isn't return on the software investment, and there's probably a long way to go before there is return on that investment, and that's where the ructions will happen as to how long the markets will continue to support the software companies.
Perhaps one way to explain it in the easiest way is it's a bit like the 19th century railway boom, because what you had in the 19th century was a sudden new technology emerged, investors got incredibly excited, they poured lots of money into the sector, and then unfortunately you had a crash. So lots of people actually lost quite a lot of money. However, the railway tracks that were built with all that borrowed money stayed in place, and we're still using them 150 years later. So if you're really optimistic, you could say actually what's happening is a mirror of that, and we'll be left with all these data centers and chips even after there's some kind of financial market correction. Or the real concern for some people looking at it right now is that, unlike railway tracks, software and, say, even computer chips tend to lose their value after a few years. They don't last for 150 years. So this could end up being wasted. But nobody's doubting that this is an incredibly exciting technology, whatever happens in the markets.
Dr. Gillian Tett, I've got that right now. Dame Wendy Hall, thank you.
It's 12 minutes to nine. Italy's parliament has just voted unanimously to approve a landmark bill that makes femicide, the killing of women or girls on account of their gender, a standalone crime punishable by life imprisonment. There are critics who say the legislation won't work and that Italy needs serious investment in education to reform a deeply patriarchal society. But this is one of the most popular initiatives of Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's government, and it makes Italy one of the very few countries in Europe to have a femicide law. Sarah Rainsford reports from Rome.
There's a colourful gathering of people here around the fountain in the centre of Piazza della Repubblica here in Rome. You can see lots of women in pink scarves, people setting off flares, pink and purple puffs of smoke heading up into the sky. This is a march against violence against women, and particularly against femicide, the murder of women because of their gender.
It's not that the numbers are so much higher in Italy than the UK, say, but this is a rare issue that gets broad political consensus. So the government came up with a law against femicide.
Salve, buongiorno, BBC.
Judge Paola Di Nicola is one of the authors.
La morte di una donna commessa come atto di odio.
And this is now Italy's definition of femicide.
O come atto di controllo.
The murder of a woman driven by hatred, discrimination, or the desire to control because she's a woman.
Vengono letti come delitti.
Talking of such crimes as rooted in exasperated love or strong jealousy is a distortion.
In termini romantici.
That uses romantic, culturally acceptable terms. This law means we will be the first in Europe to reveal the real motivation of the perpetrators, which are hierarchy and power.
Gerarchica e di potere.
It's important to introduce the word femicide.
Gino Cecchettin's daughter Giulia was murdered 2 years ago by an ex-boyfriend. He wouldn't accept that their relationship was over. Filippo lured Giulia to a remote spot and then stabbed her repeatedly.
It's a different homicide. It's an homicide related to a difference of power.
He said he killed so that no one else could have her. Giulia's sister then made a speech in which Elena called him not a monster, but a healthy son of a deeply patriarchal society.
From that moment on, we started to talk a lot in Italy about this.
Gino likes the new law, but his focus is elsewhere. There is no sex education in Italy, and Gino wants that and emotional education in all schools here.
What happened to Filippo and Giulia is underlining what important is to manage emotion. Because if you feel everything black while your girlfriend has split it up, you are in serious trouble because you cannot handle this emotion. And that comes to the worst decision you can do.
I just stepped into a exhibition space here in Rome. The exhibits here shows a mother with the mop, man with bottles of beer on the table and the remote control. There's also a speaker playing out wolf whistles and catcalls.
Hey, bella.
And there's a display in the corner, which is about femicide.
We are in the Museum of Patriarchy. This is Museum of the Future, when the equality between women and male are succeeded. At this time, also the violence is not a problem.
So this is when all of these problems are in a museum because they're part of history.
Yeah. There are a lot of forms of violence, like a pyramid. We have to start to deconstruct and destroy the base to destroy the worst problem, the femicide.
When you talk to women here about the femicide law, they all say that this is a phenomenon which comes from society and that it is society itself where there needs to be changes. And this museum, I guess, encapsulates many of the problems that people here see. Not unique to Italy, but certainly on many of the indices of gender equality, Italy is pretty low down the list.
Chi altro deve votare? Grazie, ringrazio tutti.
The final vote in Parliament came after hours of passionate speeches, but not a debate. They all agreed. The yes vote was unanimous. From now on, those found guilty of killing women because they are women will face a life sentence, and every single femicide will be properly recorded and counted.
Sarah Rainsford reporting there from Rome. Over on Radio 3, Tom McKinney is about to play one of the most haunting and mysterious pieces of music ever written, Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. Alternatively, you can stay with us here on Radio 4 for this week's episode of Life Changing, Dr. Sian Williams, just after the news at 9, and of course, full budget coverage from 18 minutes past 12 on Radio 4.
But it's 17 minutes to 9 where we are now. After a 3-year wait, it's back with a fifth and final season, Stranger Things. Here's a clip from the trailer for season 5.
We have a plan. It's a bit insane.
Yeah, what could go wrong?
No idea. But I think we should find out.
We will. Episodes will be staggered, not all brought out at once. Stranger Things, of course, wants the jewel in the Netflix crown, but with such staggered releases, has it lost momentum? Let's talk to Paul Edwards, self-styled superfan. He runs the Geek Garage, a shop in Wickford Town Centre, which he's decorated to mark the return of Stranger Things. Paul, how's it looking?
Hello, good morning. Yes, looking absolutely super. I'm really excited for it to air at 1 o'clock tonight in the morning. So, yes, really, really exciting.
And the decorations, tell us about those.
Decorations? Are we lucky? We've got like Funko and Loungefly behind us and Netflix. So they've got all the window graphics done. We've got a massive 2-metre banner in the store. We've got a giant Vecna coming out the wall, Demogorgons, loads of merchandise.
It sounds vivid. Stephen Armstrong, morning to you, Observer TV editor and writer. That sounds a pretty dedicated space to be in. On that question, let me just ask around momentum and Netflix and whether it's been played right, how this has been released. What do you make of that?
Well, I think, I mean,
Netflix was dropping the first season of Stranger Things when my two daughters were pretty much at the peak interest level. They were of the same age as the cast members, and I was of the same age, same age group, and the same sort of registers as Winona Ryder, and the 1980s, 1990s references, all this kind of playing around with culture. So for us, when it first dropped, it was essential viewing. It was one of the last things that we shared the sofa watching. And I think that was one of the big experiences that brought Netflix from being a certain kind of quite culty, quite high-end TV platform into something that was really strongly a family platform. And the first three seasons came out in pretty rapid succession. The third season was criticised for being not exactly great. The fourth season then took a long time to come through, and it was a sort of slight return to form. But I was checking with my daughters last night when I knew it was coming on, and the first one said, well, you know, I'm a full-time job now. I've got a work stream tonight, I'm not really going to get around to seeing this. Maybe at the weekend I'll come down and see it with you, or maybe why don't we just wait until Tess, who is my younger daughter, is back from university, so we can watch it together and try and reclaim that. So there's just no urgency and no sort of this is the thing that we have to see, which there is with a lot more content, particularly, I mean, even from Netflix. Netflix is competing with itself. So I think this has really lost steam.
Do you agree with that as a super fan, Paul?
As a fan and selling merchandise now, I'm going to say no, because it's like the older generation's still there, like me and others out there that liked it from the beginning. And there's a new generation, which is what we're seeing in the shop, that the younger generation are now getting into it. They've all been watching it all the game from the beginning. So I'll certainly agree slightly, but in a way, with merchandise going, I think there's a whole new audience. Again, just like his daughter's there, there's a new lot of kids that are growing up watching it now for the first time, and they're now hooked on it. So I think this is going to be a very, very big ending for this.
What is it for you? You know, this is a group of young friends, or how it started in Indiana, who get involved in a series of supernatural events. But what is it about the plot and the story for you?
Do you know what I like about it? I was born in 79, so I'm a child of the 80s, which was like the best ever. So growing up watching like the X-Files, Twilight Zone, and it brought all that back, plus more with all like the 80s nostalgia, the music. You've got Robert Englund as Freddy Krueger. There's a reference to Michael Myers. So they've kept some of this little 80s horror nostalgia in there, and I think that's what hooks us older audience a little bit more, because there's a bit more reference. But the music and the show completely, I think, is amazing. There's never been nothing like it, so...
Well, of course, with Kate Bush coming back to the top of the pops as well, which was a moment in itself, and I had to describe it in such a way. Stephen, also one of the stars, probably has had a lot of press lately, David Harbour, who was with Lily Allen and now the subject of her album Or Not. There's going to be some interesting press around it, or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's he has developed a reputation. Millie Bobby Brown has developed a reputation amongst certain age groups. People have, I'm reliably told, don't like hers anymore. Paul Noah, who plays Will, he's got into some social media trouble. This is the problem, I think, with the long pause, is it's a bit like doing Home Alone with Macaulay Culkin and then leaving it 10, 15 years until you do Home Alone 2. At this point, you've got Macaulay Culkin is not as cute as he was. The people, the stars, the young kind of cute, oh, I relate to poor old Will stars, they're now kind of grown up and they don't look quite as cute or quite the same. It just feels different. It hits differently.
Stranger things have happened. I'm sorry, I just had to do that.
Oh, dear.
So, Stephen, are you staying up like Paul till 1 o'clock
no,
in the morning?
No, I'm not. I'm really not. I wish I was. I did for the first three, but